Hey, I'm good on anything. Just like gravy, baby. Good to see you, my man.
You too, man. Hey, I finally read Prince of the Pauper.
Oh, is that right?
Didn't get it.
For reals?
Satire. Boom. I gotcha.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator in this journey into the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, Sejun Serowik. Sejun?
It is a dark day, Devin. A dark day indeed that we must dive so, so deep into the well. Some might even say chum the bottom of this well today, of all days.
I'm really hoping that you're about to say satire, because I have to be honest with you, I really, really liked this movie.
Oh my god. I wanted to walk out of this movie faster than the native actors on this movie did.
It was only four, but let's...
Nope, it was 24.
According to everything on the trivia for the IMDb page, which I know is crowdsourced, only four people. It was over-exaggerated, only four people actually left the set. But I'm not here to simp for it or anything like that. The fact of the matter is, this movie, when it is consumed in a vacuum...
So Variety confirmed that it was two dozen. Just putting that out there.
Okay.
The article I have in front of me is from Variety, so...
Well, one of the actors who actually walked away said, no, it was really just four of us.
Yeah, well...
So, again, I'm not trying to defend the movie. I'm not trying...
Anybody that's watched it understands exactly my stance at the moment and probably raising their eyebrows at Devin's.
Again, I did not know any of this. This is a movie that I came to. The Ridiculous Six is a film. You know how you can tell that I did not see any of these movies except for I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry before embarking on this season's theme of villains? If I knew anything about these films beforehand, the order in which we watched them would have been completely different. Like 1,000% the order we watched these movies would have been different.
Yeah, how so?
Well, because this movie literally takes place. The movie we're discussing today is Ridiculous Six, just to make sure, because we just kind of leapt into the conversation, which is appropriate for a film like The Ridiculous Six, because they just kind of leap into moments as well. But we'll get there, right?
Running off of the assumption that if you clicked on the title, you saw what we were doing today, but sure, yeah.
You know, I just also want to make sure that if maybe you just stumbled upon it or...
This is for your friend in the car that you're awkwardly making listen to this, and you're saying, I promise, at some point, they're funny and not racist.
Right. Well, I don't think that either of us are being racist yet, right now.
Yet.
I mean, you know, this... Well, it's dicey territory. Let's just be honest with it. It's dicey territory. If I knew anything about these movies, first of all, I saw Uncut Gems, too. I probably would have put Uncut Gems in the beginning. I would have watched it in January because that's when it was released to the world. We finally got to see it in January after the like New York and LA short thing so that it could be considered for an Oscar. And also it was my birthday movie in 2020 and was like kind of my last movie that I saw with my whole family because something happened in 2020 that's not great. But that we're still dealing with, right? The COVID-19 pandemic. So I would have popped Uncut Gems into the beginning and I would have just gotten it out of the way. Because there's Yep.
I'm just going to sit here and point out that we have not talked about the movies that we're necessarily doing that far into the future with everybody yet. Because there was a chance that they may be moved around. And now you're putting it on tape. Just putting that out.
Oh, no, no. I have a different thing. We're going to talk about that after the show, Sejun. Apologies. Satire. I don't know. I'm sorry. It's one of those situations where Uncut Gems, which was our sixth villain, would have probably been the first movie that we did. And then I would have done this movie, Ridiculous Six, would have been our episode for February, because it literally takes place in February during Valentine's Day. There's a scene on Valentine's Day in this movie.
Yeah. What is the where are they supposed to be?
Well, they wind up in Utah, so...
Yeah, so here's the thing.
Colorado, I think?
maybe it's just the nature of looking for this movie on Netflix, and like the three things that come up immediately when you search for it are The Ridiculous Six and then Hateful Eight and then Hateful Eight, the like the long cut. But the idea that they are in the out in the wilderness in February at that time in Utah, they would have been like the whole plot Hateful Eight would have been basically what we saw here. Like, it was ridiculous how much sunshine and heat and the amount of animals and bugs that were just around. Like, they kept saying it had to took place in February, but at no point was I just like, man, this feels like this is a wintry movie. Like, it was
that's not true. There's that one moment where Lil Pete is hungry and there is snow on the ground. So, but there's no way that it's actually February, but we are told explicitly that it is February because that's how they can rob Edgar's annual high stakes poker game.
Yeah.
We are all out of order and I love it. I love it for this movie.
Which felt very Maverick, but Maverick took place down in Louisiana. So it was a real weird.
Maverick was in the Southern United States. Yes, you're not wrong about that. Cause Maverick was all over. That was his thing. He traveled around to meet up with gambling competitions.
We'll talk about influences in a minute. Ooh. When we get to some of that, because there's a whole bunch of that sort of stuff going on that we need to. Anyway, sorry, yeah. You were talking about a rundown of some stuff.
Rundown of some stuff, right? So this, I would have put this into February because it takes place literally in February, and then for March, let's just talk about it. That's probably where Chuck and Larry would have wound up. It either would have been there or Funny People. Those would have been
Chuck
the
and Larry
two.
In June, I would have argued, but you
well,
know,
see, but let month. Me finish my argument, and we'll get there. But I think I would have put it probably in March, Chuck and Larry in March, then Funny People in April because it is Seth Rogen's birthday in April, and I'm that kind of wacky guy, and then That's My Boy would be May because it literally takes place over Memorial Day weekend. That's a big plot point. And then I would have put Spanglish in June because it's the whole, oh, it's the summer and we're going down to the coast for the summer. So that's how I would have done it.
And now everyone has an idea of the thin threads that hold this show together.
Right. But that's the beauty, right? I want to show people how the sausage is made every once in a while. But the fact of the matter is, and the reason why I talk about it is, I just want to prove to people that, like, that's how my mind works. I would very much love to tie in, even in a thin way, whatever it is we're watching.
Movies in real time. He still hasn't finished the 5-year engagement, so don't tell him what happens.
Oh, please don't. I next year, excited. I'm really excited. I started that film When Harry Met Sally, and they meet, and then they don't see each other again for 2 years. So October 31st, 2022.
Forever, yeah, one day he started Bicentennial Man, so we know he's going to live for a while.
Solid. Also AI, right? I've really hedged my bets. Yeah, but that's the thing that I would have done. So the only reason I do that is that's how my mind works. I try to watch movies, and especially thematically for the show, I want to be like, oh, well, it's Valentine's Day in Ridiculous 6, which is why we're watching Ridiculous 6 for Valentine's Day.
I do have to say that I feel like holiday movies get this weird feel to them when you don't watch them at the right time. Like, people like raise eyebrows about it, and that does seem weird to me. Like, I get that, like, it's fun to stick with a theme, and that's what you're getting at, is like, we would stick with it because it would give us something, right? And it'd be a fun thing to do. But at the same time, watching this movie now, not at Valentine's Day, felt just fine in terms of movie watching. Let me be clear, I did not feel fine watching this movie, but I felt fine about my place in time watching
right.
this
and,
movie.
And I get that. I understand that. But it's also, this is not really like a Valentine's Day movie.
No.
There's just the fact that, oh, the annual poker game where General Custer, Wyatt Earp, Mark Twain, and John Lovitz in the past get together and play poker because they're all alone. But John Lovitz is married to Whitney Cummings, right? So I don't know.
I'm going to dial this back, I promise. I am not going to try and be this outwardly unfunnily mean the entire time. But I would argue at this point in time that there's no good time of year to watch this movie.
That's an argument. That's a solid argument. And it's an argument that I can, you know what? I can't even get behind it. And really, it is the fact. So I have demonstrated to you that if I had seen any of these movies prior to watching them for the show, I definitely would have structured our schedule completely different.
So put your pitchforks down, people.
But my first impression watching this movie, for the first 24 minutes and 58 seconds of this film, I was like, is this like a serious Western? I was so like, it's like, oh, it's got like some little Adam Sandler jokes, like the fact that his wife is playing a character named Never Wears Bra, and just like little jokey stuff, like when he takes out the Left Eye gang and he shaves the one guy's hair and puts it on the other members of the gang. Like, those are fine little like comedic moments, but they're sort of subtle. And at the base of this movie is a pretty serious story about an orphan who, you know, we'll get to the synopsis, but an orphan who finds out about his father and then has to set out on this quest to save him. It felt like a Western. It really led like a Western.
I can come with you on this journey because of two facts. One real fact, one big fact, and one kind of hanging on to that first fact. The first fact being that Adam Sandler, we have never considered him anything but earnest, right?
Yes.
Like, he always is committing to, I say the bit, but the bit makes it sound like it's a joke, and it's not a joke. Like, he commits to character and commits to story in a way that leads to funny and sometimes leads to uncomfortable funny. And so there is a commitment to what they're doing in this movie that cannot be ignored. I will give you that. And to that, what they are doing in this movie in making a Western, yeah, like, it sticks to that really well in that aspect of it for sure. There's some other stuff that they're attempting in this movie that gets in the way of that. If this movie were just that, I'd be so with you on, like, being able to enjoy this movie despite some of the weird stuff within it. And because the stuff that goes on in this movie that ends up getting in the way is beyond weird. It is straight up unkind. It is not fun to watch because, like, people got hurt because of this movie. And, like, and going forward, like, some of the stuff that ends up, like, kind of coming from this movie.
Right. And honestly, this is a movie I sat down on Monday night, I watched this film, I watched it with Dale, and I was in. And like, and it wasn't until the Burrow literally blasted diarrhea like a shotgun.
To the point where I'm pretty sure it killed it, dude. I'm pretty sure.
Well, that's later on. No, I'm talking just the first time that Burrow shit.
Oh,
and that's what happens at 24 minutes and 58 seconds.
What's his name? That's what I was thinking of. That scene.
What scene?
I can't think of the actor's name.
Chris Parnell?
Chris Parnell, thank you.
Yeah. When Chris Parnell definitely gets killed by donkey diarrhea.
Yeah.
Like, there's not a doubt in my mind.
That. You mean the moment before
but
that.
But I mean before that, where Ramon and Tommy first meet each other, and the donkey, in response to that, shits all over the wall of the barn, and Ramon earnestly looks at the camera and goes, "That means he likes you."
I don't know what to tell you, Devin, except I'm sorry that it took you that long to figure it out.
Well, no, I'm just saying, like, it was this thing. But because I was, like, invested on that level of it, that level of investment continued for me. And even though there are some moments that are, like, just straight out there or, like, bring everything to a halt, generally, I really enjoyed this film the first time through. And I was expecting, when I was taking notes, to maybe, like, be sick of that, like, I like, now that I know everything and know what the film actually is, it's not gonna work for me. But I liked it just as much the second time. I struggled to understand why people were so against this film, and then of course you start reading things, and you know, and the one that really stuck out to me watching the film, going through the credits, is they thank all of these indigenous and native peoples for their assistance on the film. So I'm like, oh, it looks like even though they have all those moments, at the end of the day, it does feel like they're trying to satirize what Westerns are and the types of stereotypes. Something we legitimately just discussed on the Say Report with Dudley Do-Right. But it is something that Adam Sandler, with his type of comedy, it actually felt like he kind of achieves, or at least to him thought he achieved. So then reading the articles and seeing that article from Variety that 24 people walked off the set because of the negative representation of the Apache people in the film, and then also seeing members who had walked off the set say, no, that was over-exaggerated for the press. It was really just four of us, and we had a discussion about it. Like, I didn't know, but not knowing that, watching the film, having it exist in a vacuum, I enjoyed my time with the Ridiculous Six. And that is my first impression of the film, and that's where I kind of want to start.
Kind of basically the first time I watched this movie didn't go past being introduced to the likes of Sexy Fox and No Bra and like
Smoking
Beaver's Breath
Fox.
And whatever. Like, yeah, like you're right. We should get the offensive parts as correct as possible because, yeah, no, like turn the movie off at that point. The first time I ever watched this movie, then like later on, like somebody else wanted to like watch it amongst a group of people. And it just became a thing that we just did that night. So that was like the way that I had gone through it. Today was the only time I've gone back and watched it in full sense. And like put it off till the last minute today because I just did not want to watch this movie. But yeah, like the portrayal of Native Americans in the movie, the portrayal of Mexicans in the movie, the portrayal of Asian Americans in this movie, like it is just, there's just nobody comes out untouched. And there's a lot. Man, I don't want to say these two movies in the same sentence because I do not want to give this movie the credence. But there is a lot going on in this movie that is, first of all, stolen straight from Blazing Saddles, but moments of Blazing Saddles throughout this movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the difference being is that Blazing Saddles is making a commentary on the year that it's in by using a year 100 years earlier. It is a movie set in 1874, making fun of 1974, and then they turn it on its head in the end when you see that they run off the movie set and they come into 1974, and it is beautifully crafted in that way. This movie is taking the stance that it's making a statement about a thing at a time when that thing is no longer happening. We are not producing over a dozen westerns
in a month.
people aren't winning Oscars for their portrayals in westerns left and right. Yes, it will happen. I'm not saying it's impossible, you know, but those westerns are then ones that always have like a twist to them, like Brokeback Mountain or something, right? Which is a whole other exploration from a different side of that lifestyle. But like, I mean, cowboy, by the way, not gay. I don't even realize I should clarify that.
They're sheep herders, but understood.
Yes.
Well, they're not cowboys. They're not cow punching.
I'm sorry for not being specific in that terminology. I apologize. That was definitely the thing I was being careful about in that sentence. the idea being, though, that like, the ways in which Blazing Saddles did what it did at a time when it needed to be done in a way that really spoke to that, this movie doesn't have anything that it's aiming for, and by that very nature doesn't really have a specific thing to say. So really it just becomes an excuse for them to just be racist. And there's never a moment where that racism is given any type of credence or exploration or anything like that. There's no dissection of it. It is just racist.
Well, I mean, I'm certainly not going to excuse Rob Schneider's portrayal of Ramon and the way that he is a Mexican stereotype, talking about taco trees and hard shell tacos a full, like, 50 years before a hard shell was ever even, like, invented.
Or a white kid from New York portraying the only real Native American we get to see the whole time, and he's not Native American in the movie. They don't try and say he is, but then he is treated that way the entire time. So it is like this white guy acting like he understands the suffering of Native Americans because he was raised by them. There's a lot more offensive stuff than what Rob Schneider does. Rob Schneider definitely does offensive stuff, but like the naming of what's going on, the practices that they show that are just nonsense. And then on top of that, the portrayal of Adam Sandler as a character that, as being raised by Native Americans, it seems to be allowed to do a lot of things that are attributed to the people within this film. And some of them aren't even real. It's insane. The created world of what Native Americanism is in this movie is so offensive. And like to the point where people walked off set. And you can argue that it was only four people. That's still four people.
That's still four people. I know. I'm not arguing it. I'm just saying there are those. It's that conflicting story that I saw. And it's not like it made me feel better to see, oh, it was just four people. It wasn't those 24. It was the fact that like, oh, this is something I had no idea about. And it really recontextualizes this film.
I mean, that's also crazy because it was such a big deal. Netflix at the time, like they had paid this much money to do a deal with Adam Sandler, who was suddenly, it looked at the time, no longer going to release movies in theaters. Like he was just going to be a streaming guy. It was a huge move, a huge shift. And then the very first movie they make together, they have people walking off set because of how offensive it is and talking about that. And to the point where the conversation becomes, is Netflix going to not put a leash on him? And they haven't, let's be honest. But in retrospect, we know they never did. But it was that idea that like, oh, Adam Sandler is finally being given the ability to make a movie he'd always wanted to make. And sure enough, it offends everybody. So it also reflected really bad on the ways in which Adam Sandler was moving forward with his career, because it basically looked like he took the opportunity to go off the deep end and become another one of these just rich white assholes that just was like, I don't care, I'm going to get my money. And like, that is a lot of what's going on. It's just that you have that whole story that like the world lost its freaking mind to for a little bit there. Like, so the idea that you never heard it is so foreign to me. Like, I just can't even understand, because of the ways in which this wasn't just about Adam Sandler. This was also about Netflix. This was also about streaming. This was also about the ways in which, otherness was portrayed on screen. There was all of this stuff that was in the water at that time that this was coming out in the middle of.
Yeah. And I honestly, and you can say what, like, maybe my head was in the sand, maybe I just missed it. It is not something that ever touched me. And it came down to, this film looked like, to me at the time, it was 2015 that this came
2015
out?
2015 is when the movie comes out.
Yeah.
I believe the walk-off was late 2014, might have been 2015.
Right, no, but the 2015, the reason why this felt to me, and it's one of the reasons why I never paid it any attention before it came up on the show, this felt to me like Vampires Suck or Disaster Movie or Meet the Spartans. It felt like Adam Sandler, because of the cachet that he had, was taking a stab at the Hateful Eight. And that's what this film felt like to me. And as somebody who was excited to see The Hateful Eight, I'm like, you know, I'm not really, first of all, I've never, if you listen to us talk about Scary Movie or any of the other sort of like parody films that came out alongside like their more serious brethren, I really didn't give those the time of day. It's not something that ever interested me. So seeing this, I'm just like, oh, it's Adam Sandler, and this is what he's doing now. And it kind of makes sense because he's with Netflix, so he's not going to do the type of stuff he did before. He's going to do closer to direct-to-DVD style movies. And that's exactly what it feels like. It feels like a Transmorphers to a Transformers from the outside looking in.
This is definitely this is definitely like a history thing, like a context thing, right? Because I never not thought of it as anything but Magnificent Seven, especially because of what the story is of getting a gang together to right a wrong that they all have some loose connection to. And, you know, so like it was always just a play on Magnificent Seven. To that point, Hateful Eight was also on Magnificent Seven. So like they both were kind of aping back to the same thing. So to me, it was more like watching like an Armageddon Deep Impact style thing where I was like, oh, two different movies taking two different approaches while looking at the same subject, which was the Magnificent Seven. And like, and so that was always
right. Cause Antoine Fuqua's remake of the Magnificent Seven came earlier that same year
I forgot. You're talking about
with Ethan Hawke,
Lord Minion, and there. What's his name,
though? I don't know.
And Vincent D'Onofrio. Yeah. That's the one that has the arrow scene. I did see that one. Vincent D'Onofrio's death scene in that movie is phenomenal. Yeah. I forgot that movie had even happened. No, I was talking about the original Magnificent.
No. I understand that, but it also, yeah, you're not wrong. Something like The Hateful Eight comes along. But the reason, I guess it's the titling of it, where The Hateful Eight is very descriptive of the characters that are in that piece. So then the Ridiculous Six feels that same way. And I guess it's the same with The Magnificent Seven. But The Magnificent Seven felt so elevated to me, and it always sort of has, because that original one is a film that, like, my grandfather watched with me multiple weekends.
Right.
So it's not even something that like entered into my mind in terms of this.
so Tarantino definitely is taking a swing at the Magnificent Seven. And his whole thing about making The Hateful Eight is he wanted to make the Magnificent Seven, but make them all people you didn't like. Was a like literally has like talked about how that was his goal, was to make a Magnificent Seven that was but an anti-hero version of that. And so you have all these guys in The Hateful Eight that like none of them come out looking clean, right? You just have a couple of guys that maybe look a little bit better than the others, but at the end of the day, they're all terrible. And you know what happens in that movie? It happens. But yeah, so like I don't yeah, so that idea of it being like a satire on just Westerns in general, like definitely had that feeling. So like I guess I kind of get what you're saying is that like it was looking at a genre, but it seemed like it was a little focused on just one aspect of the genre, like much the ways that like Meet the Spartans wasn't a look at like the ways in which we look at like greased up male epic films of history. It's just let's just take aims at 300, and that's like that's funny for a bit, but not for a whole movie, right? And I can definitely understand that. But also just like some of the stories and some of the previews and some of the understanding of like who was involved, I kind of figured I knew what this movie was going to be. And then you start hearing about how people are getting so pissed off and leaving the set. And it pretty much confirmed it was what I thought it was going to be. And sure enough, this movie is exactly what I thought it was going to be.
I straight wrote it off the second I heard about it.
And I should have wrote it off is the feeling I had at the time.
So that's just the thing. Before we go any further, we should probably establish what it is we're doing here. We just kind of leapt right in, and we decided to save the backstory for a little bit later in the story. I wonder where that inspiration came from. Well, this is the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, and basically we're here, Sijin and I, to chart out our own star chart of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe and the films that would exist within it and that would not exist within it. I don't know. I feel like a terrible person with that I just described it. But basically, after Hubie Halloween, everybody was like, oh my God, there's a shared cinematic universe because of Ben Stiller's character. And everybody was asking us on the Say Report, what do you guys think that constitutes? So we decided to do this podcast to focus directly on that. And now you're caught up a little bit. I mean, we just shared a lot of our thoughts on The Ridiculous Six as it exists as a film and as it relates to the world at large. But the main thing of this show is to look at this film and see if it exists in some sort of larger shared universe of Adam Sandler films. And that's an important thing. And I think it's something that, like, is all right that we drifted away from it. But at the end of the day, that's what we're here to do, right, Sijin?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put aside your hatred and my belovedness and just break down the facts and figures and see where it comes. Which, speaking of facts and figures, do you have any for this movie outside of the extremely insane fact that Netflix released that in its first 30 days, this was the most watched thing on Netflix ever?
And that was too correct. That's not entirely true. They had to put out a correction about that, is that it was in its first 30 days watched more than anything else had been watched in its first 30 days ever. What they didn't account for was movies that had been up much longer, and there had been tons of movies that had been watched more than this movie. And they realized that a lot of people were kind of not getting that part, and so they had to put out a correction about exactly that.
Yeah,
it had just beaten 30 day records. So like, say Titanic goes up and like a bunch of people maybe don't notice because it's an older movie. But then at some point people pick up on it. There's been plenty of movies that have gotten watched more on Netflix than this movie at the time and since. But yeah, in its first 30 days, it beat all records for all other movies that had ever been put up on Netflix.
Still standing, that 30-day record?
Because everything is from that time, and then funny enough, nobody ever wants to go back and talk about it.
Netflix looked like a fool, and then
So as far as like actual facts and figures, because there's no like box office to talk about or anything like that, but the other thing that we should talk about is that it is the probably the worst movie that we have seen in terms of Rotten Tomatoes ratings. It is a straight up 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's probably the only one we will ever watch that is a 0%.
I can't believe I knew none of this about this film. I don't know how I isolated myself away from this film the way in which I did. All of this is news to me, Sijin.
The best, there's so many good, like, bad reviews of this movie. My favorite one comes from Richard Roper from the Chicago Sun-Times. Richard Roper, the man himself, says, in four words, thanks for nothing, Netflix. That's it. That's the entire review.
What do you think? They do like a 72 size font on that to fill the column space, or jeez.
Yeah, and here's the one that I really agree with, and this is going to kind of get to the heart of what's going on. But Matthew Rosa from Salon wrote this review and has the summarizing sentence for it is pretty on par with exactly how I feel about it. When it comes to its underlying racial message, the ridiculous sticks still grates, and there are obvious moments when it appears to be punching down without even realizing it. So this movie walks into the room like it has something to say, but then swings at everybody. And it's just like, you can't do that, man. So like this whole idea that like it wants to point out this racial message that it has, and that's great, and like the ways in which the brothers all come together is you know really interesting, but like at the expense of just everybody. It punches down, it punches up, it punches left, it punches right, and so in that it says nothing. Like for a movie claiming to have a message, or at least like God, I hope that that's what their thought was behind some of the jokes, that they were being, you know, that they were being progressive in some way.
Boom satire.
Yeah, this movie, it's got a straight up, I will give it this benefit. It does have a higher audience score of 33%.
Well, there you go.
So I like to think that if Will got in here, he also wouldn't like this movie, and that would make that ratio make sense.
Well, I mean, currently I have Yumi and Dale, and we're sitting at 67% audience score. So I don't know what to tell you.
The movie came out and it was immediately pretty much just fucking panned. And so the other thing to keep in mind about that, the most in 30 days, is that Netflix reported that before we learned about the ways in which they were actually tracking who actually finishes, and that a lot of the numbers that had been reported, not just by Netflix at that point, because by that point we also had Hulu, we had CISO, I think was another one included in all this, but they realized that there was a lot of over-reporting going, because Netflix is very happy to tell you how many clicks they were getting on the play button, but what they weren't telling you is how many times that movie was not being finished. And suddenly a bunch of their most watched movies dropped like crazy, and that's what led to the development of the top 10 list, is they reconfigured their entire algorithm to figure out how movies were actually being watched, and that was where the top 10 list actually started to be populated from. So the figure that this movie got, the one positive thing this movie got, was the fact that, hey, people are watching, got completely, had the rug pulled out from under it within the next couple of years. I will say that with everything that we've now seen going on with Netflix, because we stand at that point in time where they're like pulling the plug left and right on stuff because they feel like they're wasting money, I think this is where they start to learn some bad lessons. The fact that this movie gets panned, the fact that this movie gets despised in the future, and the fact that, but they don't care because by their metrics it got clicked on. And if that's where they're getting their money from, their ideas, their plays from, right? Like, if that's where how they're getting their jollies, like, then suddenly it really makes Netflix grow a thick skin real quick and be like, well, we don't have to give a shit what people say. All we have to do is get those people to press play on the damn thing. So it doesn't have to be good. It just has to be flashy. It has to be this thing. The bad reputation that it gets. I don't actually believe a ton of this stuff about Netflix. I have a lot of things on Netflix that I do enjoy and I do like, and things that don't get canceled. I know the story is always I get into something and it gets canceled, but like a lot of the stuff I watched didn't. I mean, like House of Cards and shit, like that got an ending. I'm still watching Disenchantment, and as far as I know, that's still going, like that kind of shit. But like, but the story right now is all this stuff about Netflix and like and not putting out quality content, but putting out a quantity of content so that they can just get their ducats and go. This movie would really point to a very early example of exactly that when they were producing stuff and realizing, you know, learning bad lessons.
I mean, ratioing it against what we look at as a successful film in Hollywood in terms of a theatrical release, having the most clicks and views in the first 30 days would be akin to a film being released, having a killer opening weekend, and then not seeing any sort of drop-off in its profits the next 3 weeks. So I get why they would look at that and say, oh my God, this is hyper-successful. Even though it's not really, because you're playing a different game.
Yeah. The other thing about this movie to keep in mind is where it falls kind of in the Sandler lexicon.
Yeah.
So Blended had come out before this, another movie of his that had gotten hit with a lot of accusations of racial insensitivity, shall we say. That was the most politically correct way I could say that sentence. But like with that in mind, right? Like, so people are already kind of feeling this weird bit. He's kind of at that point in his career where as we've talked about many times on this show, you have a lot of people in the wider world that are just like writing off Adam Sandler just in general. And, you know, we've always tried to make the argument that you shouldn't count him out, but like movies like this make it really hard to make that argument sometimes.
I mean, especially since a movie like this is one of those films that continues to have people counting him out. He had gone through a series of duds at the box office with things like That's My Boy and The Cobbler and then Blended, and then this film comes out and it's not better when he's not playing by the rules of cinemas. So what is the point? And really what puts him back on top in a lot of ways is something like Hubie Halloween. And that's why everybody was ready to have that discussion about a shared cinematic universe in 2020. Also, we didn't really have much else going on. So
Yeah. The last thing that I will say as far as like any like solid information out there about that, to kind of like really hone in on exactly how people are feeling both about Adam Sandler and this movie at this time, I will go back to Roper and the article that he ended up writing for RogerEbert.com. And he has this moment where he talks very specifically about Sandler and his role in this movie. And he calls Adam Sandler's acting, he calls it, a half-asleep, horrendous performance, the worst of his career. In the lead role of Tommy, a.k.a. White Knife, a man raised by Apaches to have superhuman fighting skills, Sandler can't decide if Tommy should be stoic, the leader of a gang of misfits, or a wacky Native American stereotype he likely first conceived him as, so he makes no choice outside of just sleepy. He cannot hide his disdain or complete lack of interest in this movie. That is how... That is how this movie, this is how he is viewed in this film. And I mean, you want me to stick to cold hard numbers and facts, I'm going to point to the 0% rating and the 30% audience rating and say a lot of people probably agreed with that.
Yeah, he's definitely sort of just the glue that sticks everybody together. And the time where he is the most interesting is when he is alone, because he has a couple of scenes where it's him without his brothers.
Right. I was going to say, and it just barely, because this movie's his character is at his best when he's just himself.
Yeah.
When he's not putting on a show for anybody.
That is a good point. Oof. I'm not going to feel bad about like actually enjoying my time with this film. I didn't feel like it was being a contrarian or like being like subversive in some way. It really hit some moments in my mind that like this is a type of movie that I enjoyed as a kid, and it is reinvoking that nostalgia for me.
So in that sense, there was one other movie I kept thinking of that I don't think that they were aiming for, but it really was hitting me in a lot of the same ways. Mm-hmm. And that is Kung Pao Enter the Fist.
Okay.
Which is another movie that in retrospect was hitting a lot of really bad notes.
Yeah.
So like that is the movie in my mind closest to that for me when I think about like movies I wanted to watch growing up. I mean, this is almost kind of like his Ace Ventura in a way. Like the most silly, the most characteristic, the most bizarre, like anything can happen moments. And I feel like a lot of that comes from the idea that this is the first movie with Netflix and there's nobody stopping him.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing, the big number that I want to point at, if we're talking about facts and figures on this film, is the fact that Hateful Eight, which is made by Quentin Tarantino, is a 3-hour-long film, is shot on film, has a $44 million budget to the $60 million budget that Ridiculous Six has. And that really
and again,
just
that
seems
number
indicative.
May not be accurate.
Yeah, exactly.
Because for all of the stuff that we talk about with Hollywood budgeting, we've never really gotten into Netflix budgeting, and that's because we don't know enough about it yet. Give us 40 years and maybe we'll have somebody that finally spills the beans, right? But Netflix budgeting, we are also starting to learn, is all over the place because of the ways in which they have to hide money and move money and show money to make sure that certain movies look successful, certain movies don't necessarily make as much money as maybe we thought they did. Like, Netflix budgeting is going to be the next big, like entertainment budget scandal. scandal, like the ways in which people talk about them hiding money in movies nowadays. You're going to find out streaming services was another way that they were doing it later.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Especially when you consider the fact that Netflix is like operated at a loss since its inception, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So how are they able to do a $60 million movie?
Well, and it benefits them to underreport it as $60 million when maybe it might have cost more to make, right?
Exactly. But those numbers, those reported numbers, because also Hateful Eight didn't just cost $44 million when you consider the like roadshow presentation that they did, which was not part of the budget for shooting
that
the movie.
That would be marketing, right? I was going to say from a shooting standpoint, it clearly was that cheap because it literally all takes place in one room and the woods.
right. But it's also on film. So that right there is already adding to your budget. The fact that he filmed it on like 70mm, which first you got to find the 70mm.
Well, Quentin Tarantino's the only one that has any of it left. So like that wasn't that hard.
Right. And I guess there's no cost if you're just dipping into your personal collection. But
well, I have Orson Welles' safe in the back room here, right next to my extensive pictures of feet collection.
excuse me. But yes, it is just, it's very strange to look at this movie and say, oh, that was $60 million. Can you show me another Western from that year? Oh, this one must have cost. No, this one cost less. Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I get that it's eight guys in one room, but still.
I mean, when you to its credit, when you have guys like Harvey Keitel that show up for 10 minutes, like, that costs, you know?
Yeah.
Man, that sucks. Did Harvey Keitel be in this movie to not be in Hateful Eight? I don't want to think about that.
Well, I mean, I think we're going to talk about some of the incestuous stuff when we get to Old New Borrowed Blue, but I'm going to put everybody out of the misery of the fact that it's looming over us and read my synopsis right now.
Yeah, please.
Even though we've touched on a lot of it. And I'm curious to see how you feel about this one, Seijin. Let me just take a sip of water. Any last words before I start reading?
Yeah, I thank you for this moment. I want to admit right here and right now that I do not know what Devin puts in these synopsi, and I am divorcing myself from the next 2 minutes of recorded, I was going to say film.
Yeah, okay. Tommy Dunson watched his mother get murdered by an outlaw as a young boy. Fortunately, the orphan was taken in by an Apache tribe, rechristened the White Knife, and raised to be a strong warrior who would never again lose a loved one to cowardice. His new life also brought him to another loved one, Smoking Fox, who is fearful that his temper will make her a widow when all she wishes to be is a wife. One day, after Tommy defeats the Left Eye Gang at the local trading post, a man named Frank Stockburn happens upon the Apache camp in search of a particular boy, his son, Tommy. While Tommy is slow to trust the man who his mother told him was dead, a midnight confession from Frank that he is dying from consumption and hopes to leave his son with a sum of $50,000 hidden near the camp allows the two to begin to bond. Their big father-son hoo-ah is cut short when former members of Frank's gang of outlaws ride into camp the next morning and kidnap Frank to have him lead them to where he buried the money. Frank is able to buy himself some time, sparing Tommy and the tribe, when he tells them the money is a 10-day ride from camp by a singing windmill. When Tommy is unable to find the money, supposedly buried in a nearby meadow, he sets out to follow him, intending to steal the money necessary to save his life. While Tommy knows there is no honor in stealing, he plans to steal only from those who have no honor as a workaround. When Tommy arrives at the first civilized settlement, he learns that while his father claims his mother is the only woman he ever loved, that doesn't mean she was the only one that Frank Stockburn porked, in the biblical sense. After meeting his half-brothers, Ramon and Lil Pete, they join Tommy in his quest to liberate their father. A brief stop at Frank's old hideout at Jawbone Falls, in hopes of finding the singing windmill's location, reveals another half-brother, a mute mountain of a man that goes by Herm, who informs them about the Golden Nugget Saloon, which seems like the perfect place to steal a lot of money from some bad folks. Once the quartet arrives, they learn that the proprietor of the Golden Nugget, Smiley Harris, used to run with their father's gang, and also meet two more half-brothers, Dan and Chico. Now that the Ridiculous Six have found one another, they will need to combine all of their special skills to secure the money necessary to free their father, but with the Left Eye Gang hot on their trail, this may prove anything but easy. After they twice raised the necessary funds, Frank double-crosses his children, but didn't count on the strength of the bond of the Stockburn boys to overcome any challenger, even their no-good liar of a sire.
You did what this movie did, and at some point just skips over just adding a bunch of other brothers. Also, by the way, there's a couple more here too. Oh, okay, thanks, movie. In honor of the return of David Spade to these films, can I say one thing?
Yeah, please.
I liked this movie better the first time I saw it a year earlier when it was called A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Wow, I hated A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Wow, I kind of hated this movie, so I think you're getting a theme.
So I think it worked. You know what's really good? And I'm just taking a brief step away from it. The novelization of A Million Ways to Die in the West is excellent because all Seth MacFarlane wanted to do was write a novel. And he said, I'm going to write a Western novel like I used to like as a kid. And then the movie companies are like, you're writing a novel, you should make it a movie. And it turns out that that novel was not a good movie, but it's a great novel.
Here's what I will say about A Million Ways to Die in the West. I also don't think it's a great movie, but I'd watch that over this any other day of the week. Now,
I would watch this. I really
A Million Ways to Die in the West at least has something funny to say about like the ways in which this country has grown in terms of safety acknowledgement and things like that.
True,
like
that's true.
Not exactly a strong message in any way, but it's at least a message.
Yeah, I don't know. A Million Ways to Die in the West. I always try to go back to it, like I want to give it another shot, and it never works out well. Yeah. This film, you know what? This film has a perfect. I'm going to say I have it written down in my notes. I'll get to it. Vamp for a sec while I get to the page.
So one of the things that like I don't know. I mean, like I went to school with like Native American scholars. And so I've mm-hmm. heard a lot of papers in regards to the ways in which like Native Americanism has been like overtaken and abused and warped and shifted and stuff like that, especially going to school at a time with these with these types of scholars when a lot of stuff was being looked at like the mascots and things like that. Right. And school mascots mm-hmm. being like a hot topic. So. Outside of that, moving to Utah, I've also moved to a place where like there is such a push by the indigenous peoples here to be recognized that like movies and then stuff that are filmed here are like required to, whether it's by social standing or by some type of law I'm not aware of, but they all recognize they do land acknowledgments at the beginning of their movies. And what that is like a thank you to the local tribes because of the understanding that they're using their land to make these movies and, you know, procured them in ways that were not clean, right, and stuff like that. So there's all of this stuff that I am kind of like falling back on that I am just seeing on display in this movie as all of the stuff that has been pointed out as just the kind of stuff that kind of goes unaccounted for. And like the idea that they got a soundbite from somebody to come out and say, oh no, it's okay because there was a Native American on set, has been widely disputed and like rightly put down. That just because you have one person on a film set that is part of that peoples does not give you the right to then just take hard swings and stuff at them, right?
And that quote of they were on set is even worse because essentially what you're talking about when you say I have a black friend, but then they talk about we had about 150 people on set, most of them were actually Native Americans and it was grandmothers and grandpas, and like that's how that is structured. And it's like, not only do I have a black friend, I've been to a black barbecue. Like, and it's just like,
well, and but the crazy thing about that, okay, is that anybody that then takes the time to watch this movie realizes how crazy that is, because there's literally only two scenes maybe in the whole movie, maybe three.
There's three
that would really kind of encapsulate that. The rest of the movie sure as hell doesn't.
Yeah.
And like
yeah.
So it's also a buck wild statement to talk about for 15 minutes of what is a 2-hour film.
Yeah, and that's the last thing that I do want to just, when I saw that this was a 2-hour movie, my jaw dropped. Yeah. I thought this was going to be 1:36 at the most.
Oh,
I'm like,
man.
How can this go for 2 hours?
Go back to the old DVD $5 bin link. Like, let's.
I'm like, this
and
is
maybe
a...
this movie would have been, and maybe this movie would have worked on some level if some of that had been trimmed out, right? Like, if some of the weirder, like more offensive stuff had just been left on the floor somewhere.
As long as the 12 perfect minutes of filmmaking stays in this movie,
and what might that be, Devin? You have to tell us all now.
For me. This movie has.
I know you wanted me to ask, so I am asking.
It has 12 perfect minutes, and it starts at the 55-minute mark when Harvey Keitel, catches the Ridiculous Six outside of the Gold Nugget Saloon,
yep.
at gunpoint with guns that are not historically accurate because they were not released until the 1900s. Like, the 1940s. It's not like, oh, we were a couple of years off, like the guitar and the wedding singer. No, no, no. We're talking like 50 to 60 years time.
Almost like any commentary about how they really cared about the subject matter might be kind of bullshit the second you start looking at details. But go on.
No, that's a good point. So he catches them. He catches the Ridiculous Six, but it's only five of them. There's only five who are present in front of him. And he says to them, oh, I'm going to take care of you Ridiculous Five right now. And then Rob Schneider, playing a terrible Mexican stereotype, comes by and goes, it's Sace, and hits him with a shovel and decapitates Harvey Keitel. And then...
To which
kicks off this beautiful moment of Harvey Keitel's body acting like a chicken with its head cut off, shooting his guns, which are five shooters, 24 times at the minimum. And also delivering good on a threat he made earlier to the character of Chico to shoot him six times in the head, to shoot himself, his decapitated head, six times. And it's this crazy moment where all of the Ridiculous Six are horrified at what they have just watched, at the fact that this they just watched their half brother decapitate a man, and then the body just like go on forever, and they're all horrified for it. And then Herm, who is played by Jorge Garcia, Hurley from Lost, picks up his coat and covers his head and proceeds to mime what they just watched. And suddenly they are losing their shit at just how funny his portrayal of the insanely disturbing thing they just watched happen in real time is.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to them at a campfire and they have a sing-along song. And it is like this beautiful moment of like, pure Adam Sandler. The whole cast is having a good time singing, and that
about what they will do when they meet their father. You're kind of missing the joke there. That what the song is an in-universe song from them about what they are going to do and say to their father when they meet him.
Yeah, which so but it's like it is so Adam Sandler that moment, like just distilled out. And then to go a step further, they're woken up by a baseball-shaped object landing in their camp and hitting Herm in the face. And they proceed to walk over to Abner Doubleday of Doubleday Field, portrayed by John Turturro, who invents baseball with them. And
So here's the thing, right? If the entire thing had been these moments, right, I would be so on board with you. You were not wrong. These are the best moments of this movie. And by their own example in this film, make everything around it worse.
I agree. Like it's
so and so to some of the points that I was making earlier about the issues with portrayals and racism and stuff in this and ways in which that I wish they had made a point when they didn't. This is one of the few moments where they get close. Because what Abner Doubleday is actually doing is he is forcing his Asian American slaves, because that's what they were at this time. Make no mistake about it.
I think they call them railroad workers, but you're not wrong.
But we have learned since, Devin, that
they I know that they're slaves. I'm talking about how you were taught it in school and what that was code for.
Right. Yeah. But he is forcing his Asian American slaves to basically play this game as he invents it, right? Like, is like the whole idea is that he's like, he is Abner Doubleday and forcing these people to do this thing all for the name of baseball, the American game, right? Like, it's so good. It's so close to being a really on point, like, but it's just every now and then they turn to a terrible Asian American joke or like it's just it just gets marred in some of the other like set dressing around it. If they had just let the moment happen, it would be fantastic.
Because the moment is so good when he's like, two teams of 10 players, there's only 18 of us. Two teams of 9 players, and if you can get it past me 2 times, then I'm out. All right, that's 2, you're out. No, 3 times. It's 3 strikes and I'm out.
Like that
like it's
funny.
So like funny.
That, that is good. That is taking a swing, as it were, at like something that we all still are very much a part of, that we don't think about the implications of its, like, the way that it is placed in history, like all of the good stuff you want from a satire on this kind of genre and this kind of time period. And God, I was just fucking dying for it somewhere else. The only other time you get anywhere close to it is when you have our boys Mark Twain and Wyatt Earp show up at the party, and like and there's something very drunk history about that moment for me, where, like, you know, you have these known historical figures meeting and talking and having these funny conversations and stuff, and I'm down for that too, right? Like, so there are these moments. You're
and
not
that
wrong.
Scene is just full of anachronism too.
Yeah,
because it's supposed to be 1875. Well, I mean, and Prince of the Paupers in 1881 book. So Custer would have been dead. Like,
it's Vanilla Ice playing Mark Twain in some of what is probably the best casting in this movie.
Yeah, it is. And then Mark Twain shows up at the end, too, because Mark Twain loves a party.
Yeah, yeah.
Well established.
No, like, those moments are definitely funny. There are moments to find humor in this movie. The problem for me is that it is at a price that is too high to fucking pay, with all of the set dressing being just problematic throughout those funny moments, and then outside of those funny moments, things just being downright offensive to the point of unwatchable. There's just, it is not, this movie is not worth those jokes.
I can see the argument, especially in retrospect and knowing that it wasn't, because the way that it's portrayed in the film, and I mean, like, tip to tail with the fact that they acknowledge and thank and all this other stuff, is that it was a copacetic set and everybody was in on the joke. But then to find out, no, not everybody was in on this joke.
Well,
this,
and
not,
you gotta remember,
what this was,
man, you keep pointing to the credits specifically, and that's such a perfect example of something that would have been done months after controversy. And if I was Netflix, do you know what I would do?
I would want to clean it all up.
Thank you to all the people. Like yeah. Something to make them happy. Like, it is such a hollow gesture. In retrospect.
Yeah, no, and I'm right there with you. It's just the fact that I didn't even know that there was something that a hollow gesture needed to be performed for.
I know, and that is the really dangerous part.
Yeah.
Right? Is that becomes the thing where, like, we learn these things as we grow up. We learn these things, maybe we learn them 2 days after the fact, but you learn this thing after you've been in a position to form an opinion. And the problem out there is too many people out there that get so caught in defending their own opinion that they can't acknowledge that other opinions might have a point, you know? Right? And so, like, there's this idea that, like, so you missed all of this. You watched this movie, you enjoyed it, and you didn't think about these things. The only hope that I can bring to this table is that at some point, if you ever revisit this film, you find yourself thinking of those things in those moments. I'm not even saying don't watch it. I'm not saying don't enjoy it. It's just that idea that, like when someone comes to you and says, hey, this thing that happened in this movie is just not cool with me, like, it's very, very common nowadays to then just, like, just a group of people to just, let's face it, dudes on the internet, to just fucking hogpile on about all the ways in which that person is wrong. Like, take the opportunity next time to see if maybe that person might not be wrong. That's all, you know?
Yeah. I mean, as much as I enjoyed it, as soon as I read and followed up with it, and I'm sorry, even in this moment, I didn't know, like, I saw the Variety and then I saw the retraction statement of it. So that's the one that took.
And the retraction might have come after the Variety article that I'm citing, and that might be the very one that you're talking about. And in that case, it is what it is. Whoever is being open or honest about it, they could not, the one truth that is present in both articles
is the fact that somebody walked off of set.
Somebody was upset enough to walk away from this film in disgust. And that is a thing that should be acknowledged.
That's huge. It's huge to have someone walk off of set for a movie because they feel the portrayal and what is going on is being offensive. Yeah. And actually, what's even worse in that retraction article is the fact that they're like, it's satire. We're clearly trying to shine a light on how Hollywood has created these stereotypes, and then those stereotypes persist. And it's like, by persisting the stereotypes, that's how you guys are trying to call attention to that?
Like, my argument would be you didn't go far enough. Like, yeah. If that's what you wanted to do, then, like, literally turn the camera around at that moment and show Adam Sandler's name on a producer's chair and then turn back to him so that he could be like, oh, right, I'm in charge of this. Because, like, you don't get to be the racist guy on screen claiming that what you're doing is calling out racism. No, you've got to acknowledge that. Like, it's also one of the best things about something like A Blazing Saddles, where you have this beautiful portrayal by somebody like Gene Wilder, character who is not he is not racist. He's not as racist. This is the best way to put this. He is not as racist as the bad guys in the film, and very much is acknowledged as being like the good white guy in that story. But he also at moments does get called out for problematic things about his character, right? Like, it is not hidden that he is not a perfect character. And the ways in which we are supposed to believe that Tommy, I'm getting the name right? The ways in which we are supposed to believe that Tommy,
you could also
is,
call him the white knife if you really wanted to.
I really don't, though.
I know you don't, Siege, and I'm making sure everybody knows who Tommy is, though.
Right. But the ways in which we're supposed to believe that Tommy is this perfect white male figure, and the ways in which he doesn't see race, it is that common misconception by like mid-2000s like somewhat progressives, that by claiming that you don't see race makes you the good guy. But the problem with that is that means that you're not acknowledging the things that make people people. Like, we're not asking you to not see that this person is black. We're asking you to acknowledge this person is black and celebrate that, right? And it's like Adam Sandler never got that second half of the memo, right? And that's what a lot of this movie feels like in its comedy, is that it's trying to make this joke, but what it's not getting is how everybody else actually feels. You know what I thought of in this moment is, like, I think of is it the first 21 Jump Street where they all go back to where they go back to school and they say a bunch of words like faggot and stuff, and they like get called out because they're like, kids don't talk like that anymore.
Both of them do it. Both movies have a moment like that where, like, that's not what it is anymore. People aren't like that.
Yeah, this like people are just not like this anymore, dude. Like, relax. And it is that moment where me watching Sandler, right? And it's the first time that I feel like I'm watching like an old dude that might be a little bit more out of touch than I realized. It's your favorite uncle showing back up after being gone for a few months, and you start to realize, oh, he's a bit of a drunk. Like, oh shit. It's like, I never picked
not,
up on this one.
You're not realizing that he's a bit of a drunk. You're realizing he's always been a bit of a drunk. It's not like he went off and then came back and you're like, oh my God, he's completely different and it's got to be the sauce. It's seeing him and like now realizing what the smell of whiskey is, and like, oh, that he's always kind of smelled like that. And I guess it was fun, but then I was in bed before he was yelling at my mom.
Right. Yeah, horrible conclusion to this fictional world we created. Thank you, Devin.
Well, no, I mean, but that's the fact. That's exactly what it is. I know. And it's weirdly, like, especially when you get to, and I think this is going to be a nice way to transition into new old borrowed blue. When you look at the creative team behind this film and you see that these are the people he was working with in the 90s, like, it is really the gang is back together. It's essentially the exact same group who worked together on The Wedding Singer, which in a lot of ways is his breakout role that brought him to more mainstream popularity. And then you look at the message and what they're satirizing, it feels a lot like they're satirizing the white savior stuff from something like Dances with Wolves. And the fact that Kevin Costner plays this white man who is accepted by Native Americans and suddenly that gives him a pass.
It is definitely something that has been present in the genre. The problem is there's no moment where I feel like Tommy is the butt of the joke, you know?
Right. While I agree with you, I think this movie just comes out like, not that it would have been excusable if it came out in the 1990s, but the sensibilities that are on display are very much the type of satire that we were seeing in films in the 1990s.
I mean, no joke, when I said it earlier, like, I compared this to an Ace Ventura in terms of what it is, and like the last 30 minutes of Ace Ventura, we've talked about how upsettingly problematic it is and the ways in which it treats the idea of like a trans body, and like how that would just, that just is unacceptable now. Like, I feel the same way about the ways in which this movie just treats any type of otherness in this film. Like, it's trying to make a joke at the expense of what, like, it just doesn't work.
And I guess, and that's where it really comes, as someone who didn't watch this movie in the moment and then watched it years later, it's difficult to discern whether this movie is 7 years old or 27 years old.
I will be entirely honest. Like, and so this is going to say a lot about me as a person and say a lot about where I live and all of this sort of stuff. But this movie is probably one of the only movies that, like, I won't bring up with everybody out here. Like, plain and simple, I just won't talk about this movie with some people out here for various reasons. the kinds of attitudes that exist in Utah as it comes to things like indigenous peoples and things like that, like, no matter what circle I'm in, I don't necessarily know if this is the movie I want us to be talking about in any way. Like, that's the problem, is that I walk away from this movie not wanting to admit to some people in my life that I've watched this movie.
And that's fine. And honestly, after this film, I don't think it's going to be a movie that I reference that often. This episode is an episode where I'm going to kind of get everything out that I feel about it. And then I'm probably going to remember those 12 minutes, but keep them secret, keep them safe, and keep them mine. Maybe I will, you know, in with certain people who I know are not going to go off the handle because I'm referencing Ridiculous Six, I will do Herm's impersonation of a headless Harvey Keitel. Because it is a beautiful bit of comedy.
Clearly, I'm not that concerned, yeah. Right? Because here we are putting this shit to tape, as it were, and like putting it out into the world for everyone to see later on.
Thanks for the tape, Quentin.
We also have the last of it. No, we have the last cassettes. Yeah. Also, we're taping over all of my old Foreigner tapes. I'm so mad. But you have them on
MP3, Siege, and get over it.
Laserdisc, bastard. But this idea that like, I don't want to talk about this film with people isn't coming from a place of like I don't admit to people that I watch dangerous film. It's that I put this in the category of dangerous film.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that says something when it is supposed to be just, I mean, let's face it. Sandler views this as a doofy family comedy.
Yeah.
He puts this in the same vein as which he puts like a Little Nicky or something to that effect. Right. And like, I can't put this there. I can't talk about it in that same realm and that he wants me to view it in.
And I get that. And I think that we should also look at what we have as our new old Borrowed and Blue.
Yes, let's
in relationship to the Ridiculous Six. So I'll let you go first on new.
So this is the first time that we have talked about Action Sandler. And I mean that even down to the filming techniques. The like goofy nature in which his character like is in high speed, like running across the plains and then like or like standing on his hands and doing stuff. There was a bunch of Zohan in this movie. Like that is one of the feelings that I got. But Zohan is not the only other example, because he also does like Bulletproof and stuff like that. Like, Adam Sandler is no like slouch when it comes to the idea of being in an action scene. Also, plenty of his movies have things like fight scenes and things like that, right? But this is the first one that we've seen him actually be a straight out action hero. And the moment that I think about is the moment where he jumps off the roof into the wall across the way and then drops down, and he does it using the two knives, and then you see Taylor Lautner. Poor Taylor Lautner in this movie, and we'll get to that eventually. But Taylor Lautner attempt the same thing, but with no knives in his hand, so he just slams into the wall.
It's easier if you have knives.
It's easier if you have knives. Right. So we get to see Adam Sandler be cool. Like, we get to see him be the cool action hero in this movie in a way that is brand new to us here. Like, I think the total opposite of this would probably be Hubie, right?
Right. But in a lot of ways, he's still an action hero. He's just not cool.
Well, but yeah. the he is John McClane in this movie, right? Like he is amazing in these moments and environments.
He is Captain America in this movie.
Yeah,
we'll get to it. So for the new, I mean, it's right there.
I want an action figure of this Sandler. That is how action Sandler he is. Sorry.
I get that. I'd like the whole group sitting in a dusty corner of my collection. I really want the Herm, who I can push a button and he does the... That really worked for me. His impersonation of Headless Keitel.
I want Chico at a piano. Can I get that with his hands on his hips?
Are you going to buy it at Spencer's Gifts? Because I don't think they're going to be selling that one at KB Toys.
At Target? Yeah.
No, Target will have it. It'll be in that weird NECA section behind the electronics department.
But it'll be a Target exclusive, which means that they'll get one in every store and not put it on the shelf. Sorry.
Right. Someone on staff is going to buy it. Where this is more Say Report topics, but hey, what you gonna do? I'm gonna go with an easy one to just lead off, and it's the fact that it's the first time we've also seen Adam Sandler in a Western. It's his first Western genre film, and as somebody who we have proven loves cinema as much as Adam Sandler does, the fact that it took him 20 years of his career to finally get to do a Western is... It's strange.
It is extremely strange, and we'll talk about that in when we get to my Borrowed, as usual. But yeah, I'm right there with you. It is cool and wild that it took this long. My only thing is, like, and this is not to negate you saying that this is new, it clearly is, but, like, it's a shame that, like, I don't think we're ever going to see him go back, and has not gone back, right? Unless I'm misremembering something.
No, he certainly hasn't gone back, and with the way that this film is universally panned, to the fact that, as you love to point out, it's got a 0 on Rotten Tomatoes, but also in terms of Westerns are considered risky films. 2015 was really the only year you were going to be able to make a Western. And the real reason was because...
Well, True Grit and 310 to Yuma, both name-checked in this movie, by the way, are phenomenal. 2012. Westerns. Yeah, yeah, out of the 2015 year.
Yeah, but I say that, but I mean, like...
What year's The Proposition, too? Isn't that 2016, 2017?
Maybe. It's just like, Westerns were having a resurgence.
Yes, Westerns definitely.
And I don't think we're going to see that same resurgence with Westerns. I mean, yeah, because it probably ends with The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, another Netflix original film by the Coen brothers, who did the True Grit remake in 2012.
Which is a phenomenal look at Westerns and death and everything, by the way.
And satire. Things. Like,
yeah, cannot,
first time?
Cannot recommend Buster Scruggs.
Buster Scruggs is excellent. And actually, what I kept thinking of watching this film was Buster Scruggs. And a lot of just the moments and then, like, how they made them work a little bit better.
I'm sorry. I was just like, yeah, I'm trying to see if there's any other Westerns that we could maybe point to, and there's not any. But, man, I'm forgetting that the movie that he does right after this is with David Spade, who we've already named. In which he is another action hero.
Yeah.
So, like, he really takes this opportunity when he starts with Netflix to be like, I'm going to be the badass for a
couple movies. You also got to think, like, Pixels, as much as Bremmer is a nerd, that's another 2015 film, him saying, I'm not just doing Netflix movies, I can still do movies in theaters.
Yeah.
Like, Bremmer, as much as he's, like, this nerdy game player, is an action hero. And
he's got some really good, like, car chase scenes and stuff in that. Yeah. Yeah, but the joke is that he doesn't look like a guy that is. And,
yeah, he's not cool at all.
In this movie, if he had taken his shirt off, I would have expected him to have a six pack.
Right. And we would have had Kumail Nanjiani body.
That's what we're calling it now. Yeah. I'm all for that.
It worked. But yeah, this is the first Western, and I feel like, I mean, you look at, like, 1992, Unforgiven wins the Oscar for Best Picture in 1992. And in 91, like, Dances with Wolves, like, Westerns were having a moment in the 90s, and I think it really speaks to the fact that Tim Herlihy, Frank Caracci, all these people who he was working with, like, I find it hard to believe that The Ridiculous Six is a script that didn't exist in some way, shape, or form before 2015 when this film comes out.
I think it did, and I think I think the fear is that this was a script that nobody would let him make because they took one look at it and were like, no, we're not going to let you be that offensive. Even in the 90s, they were like, no, no, no. And finally, when he was allowed to do his own thing, he's like, we're doing it. We're finally pulling it out. It's the black box. It's it's the Adam Sandler blacklist that he has.
Right. And then just for an additional new, because it ends up being important when we see things like Home Team this year, 2022, it's Taylor Lautner taking a step into Adam Sandler and being in that entire universe of Adam Sandler filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Taylor Lautner, definitely the meeting of the minds that is the two of them, because I think we talked about this when we talked about Home Team, but the idea that, like, Home Team is actually a product that Lautner actually, like, found and brought to Sandler and that kind of thing is really impressive and that sort of stuff. And so it's pretty clear, because doesn't Lautner also end up in one of the Grown Ups movies or something?
I believe he's in the second one.
I think he's in the second one, which is a couple of years before this.
Really, Grown Ups 2 is second is earlier than this? I thought it was after this.
2013.
Wow. I haven't seen either of the Grown Ups movies either. There's a real gap in my Adam Sandler viewing.
We're going to get to the Grown Ups movies.
Oh, I know we are.
But you mentioned his name, so I want to kind of jump to it if you don't mind. But my old.
Yes.
My old is Frank Caracci, because this is it has been at this point 7 episodes, I think, since we've talked about a Frank Caracci Adam Sandler get together. So good to see you back, man. And I'm sad to say that there's probably really only one more movie of his that we'll talk about, and that's Click. Some point in the future, that movie will come up, right? Like, I can't imagine we would ignore that one. Other than that, like,
what
we're
is Click?
Out.
I feel like I skipped right over that. what is the last Frank Caracci you think we talked about?
Not the Water Boy.
Would it be the Wedding Singer?
Wedding Singer.
Yeah, that was our ninth. So it's been nine episodes since we've celebrated the Frank Caracci. And you're not wrong. He really only has the one left.
Yeah, because he also does, you know, if we ever get into it, the Kevin James sideverse, parallel universe, multiverse, as it were. He does do, like, Zookeeper and Here Comes the Boom and stuff like that. So he doesn't leave the Happy Madison family. But as far as, like, Sandler-led productions that he is involved in, it has been seven movies since this movie came out, and they have not done shit together, not even a side project. So I don't, you know, it was a long time between Click and The Waterboy, or whatever the one was before that. So it had been, so it's not like it's impossible that they could come back together for projects. But considering the way this movie was received and the fact that they haven't, like, touched a project together since, I don't know if we'll ever get the pleasure again. Because I do like Frank Caracci and him teaming up. I think they do get some good stuff. And as we mentioned, there are funny bits in this movie, and, like, there are some cool bits in this movie. Like, the action bits are really goofy and funny and cool too. It is not a poorly directed film. I think pure and simple it comes down to subject matter and script. I think, like, the story and the script of this movie are just a mess for me, but, like, everything around it is really fun to watch.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. There are moments, that opening scene, the scene where I'm like, oh, is this not a comedy? Is this like a serious Western? Everything that happens at the trading post where he throws up the flower and knocks out Kid Patch and then knocks out Babyface Patch.
I'm just, like, it's, at that point, I'm already pissed off because of his whole thing about dressing like an Indian to not get, like, scalped on the plains, quote unquote, which is, like, so fucking, like, especially for a guy that supposedly has lived with American Indians, has lived with Native Americans at this point. Like what, like, such a weird, like, decision and comment and moment to that then mars, as you're pointing out, a rather, like, amazing scene that sets up his character. Because he doesn't just beat the shit out of those guys, he somehow lifts them up and hangs them by knives on, like, posts and stuff outside.
But it also shows his mercy, that it is not about dying. It is just about showing that you are not welcome here.
He hangs Will Forte by the balls with a knife in
it. He hangs Will Forte by his underpants. His dick is safe. He's not Nick Swartzen.
That's true. It's Nick Swartzen later on who talks about being in the Stubby gang, right?
Yeah, the Texas Stubbies. So for my old, honestly, throw a fucking rock, right? Not since Eight Crazy Nights have we seen a collection of every single person that Adam Sandler has been in a movie with.
New to old. Everything from Vanilla Ice.
Yeah, right? Who was just in That's My Boy with him in 2012.
Right. So, like, everything from Vanilla Ice all the way back to guys like Sandler and Lovitz and stuff showing up. And, like it was sad that he couldn't find somewhere to put Norm Macdonald in it.
Norm Macdonald's in this movie. He plays he's in the Gold Saloon.
Oh my God. There you go.
I honestly was like, is that Burt Reynolds? And then that made perfect sense why I thought it was Burt Reynolds, because it was Norm Macdonald.
Norm Macdonald. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. It goes.
The second you said, was that Burt Reynolds? It clicked for me.
I'm like, is that Burt Reynolds? And then I'm like, no, it's Norm Macdonald, which is hilarious why I thought it was Norm, why I thought it was him. And it's,
right, then.
What's really funny is. Is he says that he's doing a Slim Pickens impression, which really feeds into the whole Blazing Saddles of it all. Yeah. But it is, he sounds so much like Burt Reynolds in that moment, especially because, like, Burt Reynolds, whenever he did Burt Reynolds, he talked about hookers and prostitutes. So, like, it kind of feeds into it, Norm. I'm sorry. But yeah, seeing Norm Macdonald, like, I was so surprised to see him in Jack and Jill. And as we have learned from things like Funny People and now The Ridiculous Six, Norm was around whenever he could be. And it's exciting stuff.
I mean, like, clearly, like, yeah, it's the thing we've always talked about with Sandler. Yeah. He forges friendships. And, like, there have definitely been some people that have clearly decided to not work with him again. But those are few and far between compared to the people that are willing to show up for 2 seconds. Like just happy to just be there. I mean, God, like, Steve Buscemi. Like, we haven't talked about Buscemi amazing in this movie.
How the fuck did he get Steve Buscemi to be in this movie?
I don't know. It's like, it must have been the stars aligning. Oh, shit.
It's so fun to say that every time. I'm
Swartzen,
sorry.
By the way, did we talk about this, about Swartzen coming in as a producer? I think I would have to look deeper into this, but I think at this point, I think Swartzen might be in on some of the Happy Madison stuff.
Oh, I think he's definitely part of Happy Madison.
Yeah, because not after only just does he have go a with phenomenal it, I... turn in this movie as, like, a secondhand man to Will Forte, who, by the way, awesome in this movie.
So,
like,
good.
Yeah, Steve Zahn. I fucking love Steve Zahn, despite the fact that I'm about to shit all over the Kiss character in a couple of minutes here when we get to my blue. But I want to put it out there. I do love Steve Zahn, and I secretly I'm going to say this. My favorite Steve Zahn movie has to be Saving Silverman, with him and Jack Black trying to save Jason Biggs from Amanda Peet. Right, like that that movie. I don't know why that movie sticks with me as much as it does. I'm not going to sit here and talk about it being a good movie, but Steve Zahn, I love Steve Zahn, and I love Steve Zahn in bad movies.
Promise that we will talk about Saving Silverman on the Say Report at some point, because let me tell you, as a little trailer for that, when I saw Saving Silverman in the theater, I laughed from minute one to the end of the credits. There was not a moment that I did not find funny the first time I saw that movie.
I am literally tearing up thinking about that movie, because it is the first PG-13 movie that I got to go to a movie with friends without my parents.
That's exactly what it was for me.
It holds like a weird special place in my heart because of that. So like, it never had a chance. I was always going to love that movie.
Yeah. And what a wonderful thing for us to explore in the Save Report.
Yeah.
Getting back to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe stuff.
There's just this, the cast in this movie is enviable. I'm going to do this. I'm going to say this right now. Like, Jackie Sandler showing up in this movie and not just playing his love interest is bullshit. I'm sick of it at this point. People point out that he likes to make these movies just so that he gets to like kiss like quote unquote hot women in Hollywood. And I don't want to like feed into that argument necessarily, but when your wife is Jackie Sandler and you don't just cast her as the person you get to kiss at the end of the movie, what is wrong with you?
I mean, it's also really weird that he exploits his wife by making her the character never wears bra.
I mean, one would like to think that she has some autonomy in this, and the fact that she has shown up now in multiple movies and been talked about in this way by his character very often, that like she's in on the bit, but like, you're not wrong.
I'm just like, oh, look, it's Jackie Sandler. Oh, that was a weird scene, huh? That made me a little bit uncomfortable, what just happened.
Yep.
Okay, moving on.
I know. Yeah. I'm sick of Adam Sandler not just acknowledging that his wife is not only in the movie, but like his wife.
But then his wife gets to be married to Rob Schneider in something like Home Team. There's something going on, right? Hollywood. We'll have to investigate sometime.
Everybody wants to talk about Jada and Will, but nobody wants to talk. No, we're not going to do
that. Don't do that. We're better than that. This movie totally would have done 10 minutes on it, though. Look for that in Ridiculous 6 to the Second Power. But also...
I just realized what that actually meant, and it scared me. Sorry.
Sorry. I don't know, man. 36. Each of them have 6 illegitimate sons.
Isn't that what Human Centipede 3 did? No, okay, we're not doing this.
That's 100. There's 100 people in Human Centipede. But the other thing that I want to talk about as far as old is there is this one moment in the when I Find My Dad song, like When I Find My Father song, mm-hmm. and it is Herm has the bridge. He gets the bridge, and Herm is mute, so it's all sort of... like, that's how he sings the whole moment. And... it is just the bridge from Ode to My Car. And it is one of the coolest little frickin' moments for me. Because he even ends it with... and I'm just like, oh, okay. Like, that's so wonderful. It's just like a fun little moment for...
yeah.
For like fans of Adam Sandler's music, which honestly, that whole sequence of them singing is for fans of Adam Sandler as a musician.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I mean, like it feels like an Adam Sandler song that they all get to sing together, and that's cute for sure.
Yeah.
It hits in the right spot.
Yeah.
Can I do my borrowed? I just want to get it out there because it's not that impressive.
All right. Well, that's great because I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
So you mentioned Sandler, you mentioned the years, sorry, of the early 90s in which Westerns were really coming into fruition. And we've talked about that kind of being a really informative time for Sandler. And like, it's what, 4 or 5 years before he starts doing his own work, right? So there's clearly a love of Westerns. And like, so Westerns in general are the huge borrowed. But for me, it is so specifically Magnificent Seven with the ways in which the story is the group coming together and they all have different powers or abilities. Like that's one of the things that I really love about about The Magnificent Seven is like it's a lot like a heist film in that great way, where like everybody serves a purpose to the plan, and like it's the same thing that works in like the Avengers and stuff, right? Like one is the brains, one is the muscle. It's the same formula they use in fucking Scooby-Doo, right? Like it's that great shit. So it works for me. I'm a sucker for that stuff. So Magnificent Seven for sure. But then Blazing Saddles, like the love that this movie has for the idea of the satirical Western is so like obvious. It's just the problem is that it is reaching for the fucking stars and it never quite makes it for me.
All right. So of the ones that I wrote down, I did mention Magnificent Seven and Hateful Eight, but then staying in theme with, you know, number movies, Three Amigos, the entire sequence where they're searching for the singing windmill. The singing windmill just sounds like the singing cactus to me, of course, from Three Amigos. And also Sweet Hog Rock and You'll Know It When You See It. Like, there's just so much.
And then they spend like 2 minutes just trading off. That's a pretty sweet hog. Yep, a sweet hog. Like, they needed to make this movie any longer.
Can I tell you my favorite moment of this movie? It's a meta moment, and it is as soon as they come upon Sweet Hog Rock, which in my mind I thought it was going to be like a sexy looking pig, and then they come up and I'm like, no, of course it's a dick, right? Of course it's a dick in this fucking movie. And I laugh because, like, oh, first God, of all, Kevin. Yes?
Well, is Wild Hogs a dick joke?
Yeah, it is. Oh, so no. is old Just, dogs, but oh, don't freak no. out about it. But yeah, it is. As soon as it comes up, I was so happy that they were able to subvert my own expectations in that moment. And I laughed out loud and I clapped, right? Because I'm at home, so I don't feel like a jerk clapping for it. And then we watch the rest of the movie. And as the credits start to roll, Dale looks me dead in the eyes and goes, how did you know about Sweet Hog and what that meant? And I'm like, oh, because I'm an Adam Sandler fan. Like, that's what they call dicks in Adam Sandler movies and comedy.
I can't believe I just realized Wild Hog is a dick.
Congratulations, Sejan. Today's the day you lost your innocence. But yeah, but it really does feel like the whole odyssey of Three Amigos in that moment. And then I guess just sticking with that type of stuff, like it's all old movie things, is what the I think I wrote five. I don't even know if that's a movie, but I'm going to talk about it. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That really does feel like the whole odyssey and journey influence of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Especially when you have John Turturro there and the whole thing there.
I think what you're digging into is the idea that Westerns have always had this sense about them of being these timeless tales that take place in a very specific time, right? And like the journey, discovery, all of those elements that we love about old stories and storytelling are present there, and it's why we love Westerns. They are modern day Greek epics. They really are. And I mean, it's why you have The Man with No Name being able to be in three movies, right? Is because he doesn't represent a person, he represents a people. And it's just like, all right, like, yeah, like I can definitely fall in love with that.
Yeah. And then, like, being a jerk, we already talked about the Avengers, but good God, does this movie feel like Adam Sandler's semi-sort of answer to superhero movies being popular at the time, with the fact that you have Herm, who is the Hulk, you have Tommy, who is Captain America, you have, like, they all just feel like they represent Avengers XPs.
Taylor Lautner definitely is Black Widow.
Yeah, well, he has the car, yeah. So I'm trying to think of who has the burro, and it would probably be Ramon Iron is Man. Hawkeye.
Oh.
Yeah, because the burro is his bow. I think I'd make Dan. Yeah, Dan is definitely Iron Man, with the whole fall from grace, and he has some issues, which then makes Chico Thor, which makes perfect sense. There is no flaw here. We're moving forward. But the other thing, if we're going to talk about superhero movies, is just how much the White Knife is Batman. He is an orphan who trains so that he will never be a coward again. And it is just a normal man, but can do some mystical shit because of the training.
I'm sorry, Baronior would definitely be played by Ray Romano, right? Like,
what? Who would be played by Ray Romano?
Baronior, if you had him be a mythical burrow given to him by Odin, who had thunder powers,
oh,
and it
yes.
had a voice, it would be Ray Romano as
It would be Baronior. Ray Romano, because he would not want to be there for any of this shit.
Shit, I'm sorry.
No,
I'm
it's fine.
I'm making
it's
myself
okay.
laugh because this movie didn't. Go ahead, sorry.
Steve Buscemi is Nick Fury, if you really want to be a dick
oh,
about
man.
It. Because he brings them all together.
And Harvey Keitel's dead body is Maria Hill.
Oh, no, Harvey Keitel is...
Considering how much the Avengers movie used Maria Hill, are you really going to argue with me about
that?
That's
a solid argument. Maybe I'd go with Stellan Skarsgård and feel less bad about it.
Nice.
But yeah, so it's just one of those situations.
No, he was Harvey Keitel when he was alive.
Beautiful. Look at this guy. He got jokes. But yeah, it's one of the things where... But he feels like Batman. Like, there's just so much superhero in this as well. And again, because Westerns are folk tales, and there's this shift in American entertainment where superhero movies become our modern folklore,
yeah.
which is just really interesting. I'm sticking with the borrowed, and I'm going to say it. The fact that Lil Pete is just Forrest Gump, I'm okay with that. I'm completely fine with it. It supports my...
I couldn't stop thinking of what's his nuts, the character that Ben Stiller has in Tropic Thunder.
Do you mean who Robert Downey Jr. has? No. Both of them.
I can't think of the character's name either.
Yeah.
But the ways in which... And see, now there's another satire that I think still works, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is the ways in which he satires that exact concept in Tropic Thunder with the character that he plays is a much better... like joke and examination of, because of the fact that you then get to see him not in that character thinking about and discussing like concepts about that character and all that sort of shit, the fact that it is reflected upon, right?
Yeah.
Whereas you have Taylor Lautner in this, and he is definitely playing a Forrest Gump, but much like the issues that a lot of people nowadays point out with Forrest Gump, it's really problematic in the way in which Tom Hanks portrays that character.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, like, definitely.
Like, yeah, exactly. And so, like, Taylor Lautner doing it now in 2015 is not better.
But it's not just the fact that he is sort of portraying a Forrest Gump with this whole, hey, mama, I found my brothers, and that whole thing. It is also the fact that he is there for the invention of baseball. And the way that, like, let's just put him into everything. And his half-brother was there when Lincoln was assassinated, which this is where I'm going to just shout out Chris Kattan as John Wilkes Booth.
Amazing scene for both Luke Wilson and Chris Kattan. And Dan Patrick.
Yeah.
Wasn't Dan Patrick?
Dan Patrick
Lincoln?
Is Lincoln. But it is totally Luke Wilson as John Wilkes Booth, the actor. You want to go say hey to the president? He'll get a real kick out of that.
It's good. It's a good moment.
It's wonderful. But then the last one, and this is not really a movie, but it's folklore, and it technically fits into the borrowed, and it really does support all of this talk that, like, Ridiculous 6 in a lot of what it's doing is sort of trying to ape folklore. This is another one from Dale where she's like, this movie is just the five Chinese brothers in terms of each of them have this special mystical ability that allows them to fulfill their goal. In terms of, like, Dan can hold his breath for a really long time, like the Chinese brother who can swallow the sea. And the fact that you can't hang Little Pete because he's got the strongest neck in the West.
Yeah, yes. I mean, like, welcome to the invention of, like, hero team-ups, right? Like,
exactly.
Like, it's why Buffy works and Angel works is because Joss Whedon unlocked that clue that, you know, it's why... But then you see movies and shows like Chuck and stuff like that where, like, they always seem to have a team around them, right? Like, think about Team Arrow and Team Flash in the Arrowverse. Like, yep, yeah, that's how this all gets put
I mean,
together.
I know that's how it all
it's
works,
the
but
same
it's...
same story told 1,000 times over.
But it makes you think back further when it's something like a Western, so it's already sort of tickling that part of your brain that is folkloric.
I know, and that's why it really harkens back to something like The Magnificent Seven that really celebrates that. Yeah. Which, the one thing that we should also point out, like, I'm not ignorant to the history of Magnificent Seven, which is just a remake of a Kurosawa film, right, about the Seven Samurai.
The Seven Samurai.
Which is the same exact idea as well, right? Like it just keeps going back further and further and further on itself. And I don't doubt for a moment that, like, Sandler and his people, like, are very well aware of Kurosawa. Now, whether or not his love goes back that far, he didn't make a samurai movie, right? He made a
not
Western.
Yet.
Clearly. but that idea that, like, it is these older stories that speak to us in this way, and they are tried and true, and some people will look at something like that and call it lazy. Like, they will talk about the idea that it doesn't do much, and it gets called out for that because it doesn't add anything. Because the different, like, so, like, Magnificent Seven is this remake of this Kurosawa film, but what it brings to it is, like, a hefty amount of American nationalism and the ways in which, like, we viewed the West and all that sort of stuff. So, like, there is another window in which to view that story that movie opens up for us, right? I don't know what Ridiculous Six brings to this particular parable. Like, there isn't really anything that it introduces that is new or fun. It has the opportunity to, with the idea that it is going to be this movie that celebrates this interracial family of brothers that come together to do this thing for their father, but, like, it never gets deep enough into that to actually celebrate it.
It's all set dressing the fact that that's who they are. It's
right.
Not the core of the story.
Well, and I was going to say this earlier. You mentioned that moment where Harvey Keitel gets killed, right? Because I was going to say Tony Estrella. Not Tony Estrella. Rob Schneider.
Mean to Tony Estrella.
Rob Schneider rides in and knocks his head off with this thing, right? And I was thinking, it's probably that character's best moment. It's Rob Schneider's best moment for his character in this movie. And it's because it doesn't matter that it's him. Like, it could have been anybody that was in that moment for the reasons that it happens. Like, it does, it's not definitive of his character in any way that he's the one that does it. Like, it's wild that like, you could have plugged in any of the brothers slash any character slash anything, and it's kind of true throughout the rest of this movie, is there's never really definitive moments for all of them as much as you want there to be. There's even a moment for Jorge Garcia's character, Herm, right?
Yep.
Where he kind of almost gets a moment to do something special when they face up against their father, who, lo and behold, has been the villain all along. And they face off against him, and Herm does a move to, like, pretend to be a tumbleweed to distract him. And it doesn't work. They call it out. So, like, they even call out their own nonsensical bullshit, and the fact that, like, you could plug and play the brothers in any way and it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah. And that's really where it becomes lazy, because we just spent a good chunk of time on the fact that all of them bring something to the table, but at the end of the day, they are very interchangeable in what they are doing and what they are bringing. I mean, mm-hmm. The fact that Chico's special skill is he can play the piano with his penis, that's okay. That never
it's a
really,
funny joke.
It's a good joke, but it never comes up until the end.
If he saved the day with that ability in some funny way, that would have been hilarious.
Yeah, like
the other movie that I want to give a shout out to, by the way, just because we keep talking about Tarantino and I don't want to get too far away from it, is there was also a lot of Django in this movie, right?
Yes.
And, like, in that sort of aspect.
Oh, with Beardo Blanco?
Yeah, a lot going on.
Yeah. It's good. And also, before we move past the borrowed stuff, it is crazy to me that the one thing in Blazing Saddles that Mel Brooks was, like, kind of on the fence about was having him punch the old woman.
Yeah.
Like, everything that exists in that movie, and Mel Brooks is like, oh, do we have... I can't think of the character's name.
What?
Mongo. Is to have Mongo punch that old woman.
Yeah, when Mongo punches the old lady.
And that's like, that was like the moment where Mel Brooks is like, this might be too far. And it's like, have you read the rest of your script, Mr. Brooks?
I fear we've gone too far. Or have you not gone far enough? Of course.
Let's go into Blue. I'm going to lead with mine because you get to lead all the other ones.
Which is
fair because you didn't like the movie and I forced you to watch it. My Blue is Don Stockburn's character. And Dan Stockburn is the failed bodyguard of President Lincoln, who not only allowed John Wilkes Booth to assassinate the president, but in fact invited him to stroll on into the box to do so. And everything that he wears is blue in this film, which leads me to the fact that each of the brothers has an accent color, and it makes the whole film feel like an arcade game, specifically a Konami arcade game.
Oh, God.
Where you have Tommy, who is yellow, and player one in Sunset Riders is yellow. I'm trying to think of his name. Is it? No, not Steve. Yeah, Steve is Steve. He's yellow. And then the blue one is player two. That would be Dan. Because I totally see Luke Wilson's as like the second in command of the group once he joins with them. Ramon is green.
Let's be honest. He's one of the only trained lawmen in the group, right?
Yeah, like, exactly. So it makes sense why he sort of rises to the top with that. Ramon's accent color is green, which is crazy, but the poncho he has on has this huge green stripe that is three longer than anything else. Chico is red. Lil Pete is white to like represent his innocence. And then you have Herm, who is brown. And just like that weird color coding to like make you easily identify and differentiate the characters is insane to me, because it makes you be like, oh, it's like an arcade, or like it's very toyetic, where if these toys were to go out and they were going to do them as something other than the Ridiculous Six in old Western times, that's how you would be able to identify who they are.
Some might argue that it's a little simplistic, because what you're talking about are two mediums in which they need to keep shit simple in order to make it visibly understandable language, right?
Yeah.
So some might argue that what you're pointing at is the ways in which there's not much complexity going on. It's pretty straightforward that each of these are individual figures and this is who they are. And like, you know, it's the same way in which we color Power Rangers and shit. Like, it happens, and it's not unreasonable to do it because it is fun and cool to look at. But again, I think that, yeah, it just points to another element of it.
It points to something about the film. Like, it was one of those things where I'm just like, oh, they're all color-coded. That's a little bit weird. Yeah. And it was because, in terms of blue in this movie, for the definition that I have chosen to take at the ASCU headquarters.
In defiance of God's law.
Like, it really does come down to the fact that there's not a whole lot of blue in this movie because it's a Western. So blue is not a color you usually see out West, to just like put a pin on it. Like,
yeah. You know what other movie really highlights that?
What's that?
Django. It's the whole bit in Django when Christoph Waltz buys him the suit. I forget Christoph Waltz's character name, something German and offensive, but he buys him the suit, and the suit he chooses is the blue velvet suit. Mm-hmm. And like the whole thing is that he comes out and like with the awesome hat and the glasses and stuff like that, and it is the look of him is that blue, right?
Yeah,
yeah, it is identifiable because it is so, because it stands out like it's a, so like foreign. A sore thumb.
Yeah,
right.
So it's that and it's, and you want to think about somebody like Dan, who is sort of an outsider in this Western place, because he comes from the East. He was living on the East Coast.
Makes you wonder
if
he was a Democrat and let the Republican president just get murdered.
I mean, Abraham Lincoln was very different as a Democratic president, as a Republican president than current Republicans. But if we want to get political on this Adam Sandler podcast, this fun Adam Sandler podcast, but it is... But yeah, Dan being represented by blue, and also him sort of being the saddest of the five new brothers, because obviously the absolute saddest character is Tommy, to the fact that he drags the entire mood down during the I Want to Meet My Father song. But he has the most tragic story, the fact that what he is going to seek from his father is redemption for his mistake. There's a lot there in this movie. You could actually psychoanalyze this movie and have it mean something, but you stop when you realize that people walked off the set in protest of the portrayals.
Let's talk about My Blue. All right, let's do it. So I just want to clear the air here. It's pretty obvious by now that what I probably could have put down for my old was racism, because we've seen it before in Sandler movies. What I could have said for my new was racism, because there are some new types of racism in this movie. I could have said for the borrowed, hey, some of the racism that you see in all these old movies showed Bird its ugly head. And for the blue, I could have very easily pointed at a lot of the racism in this movie. And I chose very consciously to not do that, since I was going to talk about it the rest of the time. So for my blue, what I actually wanted to point to is a lot of the ways in which disability is put on display for laughs in this movie. Like, and like front and center of that is Little Pete, like Taylor Lautner's character, and the ways in which his character represents, as you pointed out, a very Forrest Gump-esque style character, but all for a joke. He's not shown to be the like lovable hero that actually has a point that Forrest Gump is. And Forrest Gump is already problematic. Like, add to that the fact that he's then given no agency or like intelligence whatsoever. At least there's like a folksy wisdom to Forrest Gump that's just gone from Little Pete, right? And so there's that. But also like Steve Zahn's character and the ways in which like he can't see out of one eye and they make him pull out the good eye, and then you learn later on that it was a like like not fair.
I knew
bit.
That
like,
the second that
well,
scene
I was
happened.
To find it out about all of them in that moment, right?
Yeah.
It's like when he pulls out his only good eye, I was waiting for them to all reveal that they had not done it.
I just wish that one of them picked it up like, I can't believe he did it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, something like that. I mean, we're going to get to that. And then they don't do that, and you think, oh, maybe I'm
the asshole.
Thinking they would be the joke for making that joke. And then the movie makes that joke.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's all sorts of different types of disability on display in this movie that are just like just played with. I mean, even Herm's character in a large way is like a really upsetting portrayal of somebody in that position. Like the idea that as a trapper that was raised like in solitude, like is he feral, or is it that he speaks a language they don't understand, like, oh, say Quebecan French, which would have been a big thing for a trapper at that time period in this area. Like, I mean
he dresses like a trapper, but he's really a moonshiner,
like, well, which is a whole other element,
which is a whole other element to it. And then you also like you have that one moment with John Lovett's character. Is it Edgar? I don't know. He's not whatever he is, whoever he is supposed to be, where he talks about this ugly woman and she had this mute child who was trying to sing, and like maybe he's just been mute and that's just him trying to talk, but he just doesn't have the ability. It represents a foreign language that everybody just writes off, or is just the fact that he doesn't have the ability to talk because his mother drank while she was pregnant with him.
Yeah,
and it stunted his development.
There's a lot of stuff put on display that is really upsetting in that regard. And then what happens is it gets lost and pales in comparison to some of the other more problematic shit on display, like the racism and the sexism on display in this movie. So like you don't think about it.
Yeah, but no,
so I'm just gonna take that moment. Because, also, we have not paid that much respect to the idea that there is a heavy amount of sexism in this movie, as we talked about in, like, some of the Indian naming, like, is just, like, really upsetting, and, like, the ways in which, like, different characters are treated. And, like, it's a joke when John Lovett's character tries to, like, quiet the, like, woman down in the room, but it still sucks to see, like...
She goes and sleeps with Terry Crews. Whitney Cummings gets even with John Lovett's.
Yes, and as we all know, like, sleeping with the black guy cuckolding the white character in the movie must be a severe punishment, right? That's just more racism.
I know it's just more racism, but she does it on her own. She takes matters into her own. It's not great. It's not great. But that's what they do. I do like first of all, Whitney Cummings being in this movie just proves that whole Adam Sandler also knowing the moment and what is like popular in the moment and being able to put it into his films. But when she comes up out with the beard on, that's funny. That's a funny visual.
It's a funny joke. Congratulations. You found another one. That's three. I think we've pointed out so far in this comedy movie. That's
I like when he's the tumbleweed. If we're going to talk about other stuff, I mean, it's hyper problematic with the fun little catchphrase that is supposed to make you forget the fact that we're treating Native Americans as some sort of magical race of creatures.
Yeah.
That's some mystical shit right there.
Oh, man.
One other thing I want to say before we move on, and we'll move on, and I think we're coming probably to the end, because we've experimented a lot with the format in this episode, and I've enjoyed that immensely, is the fact that Tim Herlihy, the fact that he plays a bartender in The Wedding Singer and then plays a bartender here, that made me smile.
It kind of leads to some conversations that we're about to have here in a few moments. But yeah, Tim Herlihy reprising a role in a certain fashion, definitely a throughway that we could take. No, I mean, as far as some other stuff that I want to get out of the way, like I kind of only half mentioned it, but like Blake Shelton coming in and playing Wyatt Earp in a scene with Vanilla Ice playing fucking Mark Twain, was glorious. Like it really was like again, phenomenal moments of actual like funny material in this movie that are just buried under just some piles of shit that are not worth wading through.
Nick Nolte as their philandering father.
Yep.
Is wonderful casting.
Did we name check all of the brothers yet? Right, like we talked about Luke Wilson. We talked about Terry Crews. We talked about Jorge Garcia. We talked about
we've said them all.
Yeah,
Rob
okay.
Schneider.
So we talked about Rob Schneider and then Tommy Adam Sandler's Tommy. Yeah, good. I just want to make sure we didn't forget anybody in that group. Because unless... like they do carry this movie. Like they are present. Like all of them are there. There isn't any of them that I feel is like phoning it in at any moment. The problem is like they're putting a lot of work into a product I don't agree with.
Yeah, I mean, everybody came to play and participate. I think they knew how important this film was in terms of showing Netflix they didn't fuck up by giving this incredible deal to Adam.
Yeah.
So everybody takes it seriously. It's just kind of a shame that this is what they're given to take seriously.
Well, especially when you consider like something like, I mean, even the do-over, which ends up kind of falling a little flat, but not offensive. I would have much rather that been the first one. Or then you get to something like Murder Mystery, which we have widely praised as one of his better films. Imagine if that had been the first one they had put
out.
I'm
so excited for the sequel to Murder Mystery. So excited for that sequel. And even like Hubie Halloween, like I have some real issues with the elder abuse that is on display in that film. But if sequels to Hubie Halloween, I'll watch all of those too, because of just how wholesome it is. Yeah. So they learn from this movie as well. Netflix does learn that he can't be given complete carte blanche. There needs to be some wrangling.
Yeah. Well, so the only other thing that I think I should point out is that I from everything that I'm reading from Variety on, apparently when he signed up with Netflix, it was actually only a 4-movie deal.
Yes.
But he's definitely past that at this point. Yes. I mean, like, you've got to consider, like, the week of. He has this new one coming up that's the basketball one that we're going to talk about. Like
Hustle?
Like,
is that the
Hustle,
name of that
I think, is the name of it. Yeah. Hustle and Flow? No, that's a different
movie. No, that's a very different movie.
But yeah, like, so clearly he enjoys the environment, right? Because he's gotten past that original 4-movie deal and it has been much more now, like in talks for Murder Mystery 2 and stuff like that.
Well, Mystery 2 wrapped. They've actually wrapped shooting on that film.
So in the idea that like this movie is the first one that comes out and it gets panned in the way that it does, I do think that there is something to that initial number of like the number of people watching it. And we've talked before about the idea of like the ways in which people talk about a thing that they don't want, but then like everybody kind of just consumes it anyway, kind of like fast food, right? Like everybody talks about the evils of McDonald's, but at the end of the day, everybody goes out and gets a McFlurry every now
everybody
and then.
Everybody wants a Happy Meal.
So like there's this idea that there is a market for this and maybe Sandler cracked that code. And that's something else that we've talked about before, is that he kind of understands that. He understands the market in a way that I think a lot of people get really upset about, because he seems to be able to go out there and break the rules and still make money doing it. And people don't like that. And that's a shame, because what he's really doing is he's showing how the system is just kind of like not even necessarily rigged in the wrong direction, just in the ways in which you want to take it. Right. Like, OK, so, yeah, his movie came out and it's panned. It's got a 0% of Rotten Tomatoes, but it also was the most watched movie for Netflix for 30 days. So, like, what are you more into? Are you more into reaching your audience? Are you more into impressing your critics for a good Rotten Tomatoes score? And he's clearly chosen a side on that. And that side seems to be one that he's very happy with. And that's cool. And that is him for his whole career.
I mean, let's look at the fact that Hubie Halloween, the thing that kind of started this whole train that we're on a roll in, my mother was the one who said, we're all going to sit together and watch this movie. She'll deny that up and down, but it was every week a different Decker would choose the film we watched, and she's like, I'd like to watch Hubie Halloween, because it's a Halloween movie, and it's in Halloween's in 2 weeks, and everybody's talking about it. And, like, that says something about the marketability of Adam Sandler. The fact that my parents, on their own, watched things like The Wrong Missy and Murder Mystery.
Yeah.
Like, it is very marketable. And what it is, that going back to that, so it was the four-film initial, and those four films were Ridiculous Six, Do-Over, Murder Mystery, and The Week Of. And then he was given four more, which we've now seen Hubie Halloween, the Hustle movie that's coming out, we're going to have Murder Mystery 2, and then I don't know what the other one is.
So supposedly, I don't know how much this stands now, considering everything that happened, but one of the big things that was announced in that rework of the deal is that one of them was going to be animated, and it was going to be Sandler going back to animation. Now, like I said, with everything that we've now learned about Netflix and the ways in which it's kind of cut left and right, that may not happen. Although that being said, one of their big movies last year that was Oscar nominated was Mitchells vs. the Machines. The idea of, like, intelligently leaning into the animated side of things might be up their alley, and, like, as we've learned, Sandler's a best bet for them. Like, so if they were to dial back to, say, one movie next year, and that movie turns out to be an Adam Sandler animated movie, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. I mean, that last one, that one that we're not sure, that's probably still going to be the animated, because if it's an animated film that they announced back in 2020 before Hubie Halloween came out, like, they've been working on it, because you can't just, it's a huge strain on the animator's wrists to do it live, CG.
Yeah, no, but like, that, to that point, like, you know, projects that were almost finished got, like, the plug pulled on them. Like the Netflix news was not pretty. I'm not going to pretend in any way that, like, anybody got out, like, unscathed. And so it's possible that the animated one that was on the docket for the Sandler guys is one of the ones that got canned, and they'll just do something else. But my hope is that they do another animated, because, I mean, I'll be honest, I love Eight Crazy Nights. So seeing Sandler do more animation is great. And then add to that, like, I do also like a lot of the animated stuff Netflix puts out. Like, I know that was one of their biggest houses to cut back in, because that's where most of their money was. But, like, at the end of the day, the stuff they have put out has been awesome. Klaus, Mitchells versus the Machines, just to name a few, you know.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So we'll see with that, but let's focus back up on Ridiculous Six. And I know that it's very difficult not to talk about Netflix when you're talking about the film that kicked off the roller coaster on Netflix, which is Ridiculous Six. But is there anything else that you think that we need to talk about regarding this film before we decide if it's part of our Adam Sandler cinematic universe season?
No, I don't think there's anything. I think I made it a point to write down every little thing I wanted to talk about now, because I don't really want to promote this movie for people to go out and see it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. If you still have Netflix, don't run out and get a Netflix account, especially with the way that they're raising the prices, just to watch this movie. But if you're looking for something,
it's a strong stance, my brother.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, you could check it out. But even then, I mean, as much as I liked it, and I will admit that this one really surprised me with how much I enjoyed it, I don't think I could recommend it either, because I know that it was one of those, like, once in a moment experiences that everything was functioning on the perfect level for me to just connect to this film. If I had watched it back when it was new, I doubt that I would have the love for it that I seem to after my initial viewings of it.
Well, let that speak to the idea that, like, sometimes watching stuff when the zeitgeist isn't on your back is a smarter move, for sure.
It's an interesting balance, and something that, I mean, I'm sure we'll explore more as we go further with the Say Report, especially with some of the other movies that are coming out in the zeitgeist right now, right? When this episode drops, you're listening to this on Friday, May 6th, and Multiverse of Madness is out there, so...
Yeah, I mean, Doctor Strange, no stranger to claims of racial insensitivity in and of itself, so, like, there's definitely stuff to be talked about, for sure.
Yep, that's what Mr. Magoo and Doctor Strange have in common, most of all.
Well, Mr. Magoo had some disability issues. I don't know if I would. I mean, to be honest,
not in the beginning.
I saw it, so
not in the beginning. I'm talking about the cartoon character.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Leslie Nielsen.
No, not the Leslie Nielsen. I'm talking about the beginning where he like, could see he like was just a racist asshole.
The blind came out and we're just like, maybe don't make this movie. And Disney was like, fuck you.
Yep, and they said it just like that in the way that Mr. Magoo's former houseboy used to talk.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, which is... Oh, Disney, when will you learn? Yes, so speaking of that, Seijin, where do you think this falls? Do you think this is in the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe?
100%.
Yeah.
There's like magic going on. There's this idea of like of him being this confident like loner hero, but then like needs other people around him. There is a strong independent woman that does rely on him to save her, which is a little disappointing. But at the end of the day, she has some phenomenal moments in this movie.
Like she saves herself from the Left Eye Gang.
Yeah, exactly. Like the ways in which she runs away from the Left Eye Gang and stuff like that. Like there's a lot of that good stuff going on. And at the end of the day, like seeing Tommy walk out from the shadows to join the team is definitely a visual in my head for sure.
The thing for me is this is very clearly, I think we've just spent the last 2 hours proving how much a product of the 90s this script was. If this script were a product of the 2010s when it released, I would not be surprised if the reveal at the end was that these guys were just playing a Dungeons & Dragons campaign set in the Old West. Like, that is what it felt like to me. It felt like if this were released maybe in 2022, you would have those moments removed from the game world where they're discussing this stuff. Like, how could you do that with your character? Rob, why do you always got to play some ethnic minority?
Yeah, there'd be a framing device, right? Whether it's like grandpa reading this story to his kid at home or something like that, they would frame it in some way and then use that framing device to examine a lot of the problematic stuff that's going on. That would be better. Right. I will say that.
Right. But there was this moment where I'm just like, oh, this is just like a Dungeons and Dragons campaign for Adam and his friends. So anything that happens in it that's just insane, you just wave away with the fact that, well, they roll the nat 20 and we move on from there.
Yeah, I mean, magic exists in this movie for sure. There is some magic, element of that.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Lil Pete is able to commune with animals...
Well, and there's that moment that made me think that heaven might be real when Luke Wilson there looks up to the sky and it's just Adam Sandler, but it's Lincoln telling him that he did good.
Abraham Lincoln as the connection tissue between Happy Gilmore and the Ridiculous Six makes perfect sense to me. The fact that I wouldn't be surprised if Smiley Harris were just Satan on Earth.
Yeah.
Running a den of inequity in the West while he can. I mean, look at some of those thumbs, the way that they're bitten off. And where the frick did that ventriloquist dummy come from?
Yeah, that joke was weird. There was a lot of weird stuff.
And the way that he is killed is very reminiscent of how Nikki's brothers die. Like, where it's just like decapitation, but no blood. Like, I'm not entirely unsure that Smiley Harris isn't just the devil of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe.
Man.
Which really ties into just everything. How do you feel about people saying that Dr. Steve Buscemi putting the ointment on his lips is a reference to his character in Billy Madison putting the lipstick on?
I'd have to watch the scenes side by side, but I didn't get that vibe. I'm usually very quick to pick up on that stuff.
Yeah, that's the stuff that I'm like looking for. I'm watching for that. And then I read it after fact. I'm like, that kind of feels like a stretch. That just feels like the ointment scene.
It just feels like Steve Buscemi puts weird stuff on his face was the same stage direction in both movies is all it felt like. Yeah.
Yeah.
Steve Buscemi is just kind of a weird dude and does things in weird ways. Yup.
Steve Buscemi puts ointments on things. There's also the fact that there are two Reservoir Dogs in this film, and Quentin Tarantino was in Little Nicky, like, with Harvey Keitel. And then we also go one step further, the fact that it's an Idiocracy reunion with Terry Crews and Luke Wilson. It's just, there's so much going on in this film that, like, I would love to celebrate, but when you look at the behind the scenes and the controversy, it's hard to do.
I mean, you know, it feels like it's a bunch of dudes that are friends getting around and making a movie, and they were probably making a bunch of jokes and what's the word I'm looking for? Improvisations, I guess would be the best way to put it.
Yeah.
That were maybe what friends would do together in a bar, not necessarily what actors should do on a set. Like there's that element to it too, is that we also may not have seen some of the stuff that was deemed maybe not great, you know, like we've seen edited versions down all the way down to like literally on set that day, they could have discussed what not to say and what to say. So there's a whole bunch of element to that too, where like, we don't know what else went on around it. All we have is what's on film, and what's on film ain't great.
Yeah, that's a good point, but definitely in there. And it would be wonderful if you have Eric Gordon develop time travel technology and they're able to pull, even if the whole Ridiculous Six were to come in as just, or just as like, I don't even know. I would love.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. I think it fits. I think it works in the universe for as it stands. I don't think that it would be weird to have Tommy show up in a scene with somebody like a Billy or a Hubie. I think
it would be really interesting. I would love it if it turns out that like Billy is, I mean, Tommy is their ancestor in some shape or form.
Yeah, they like go into the desert for guidance, and Tommy, like Mufasa in the clouds, comes down.
I am your ancestor. Oh, man, we're Native American?
No, really?
I am white.
No. Want to clarify right here, right now. No.
I was born to white parents. They were murdered, and I was taken in. It's like if you were born in America, but you grew up in England, you get the accent. I get
you
it.
You get to make jokes about blood sausage, but like that's don't go much further.
I want the burrow to show up. I love the burrow.
Yeah, the burrow's fine. It's the poop jokes. I mean, which also makes it fit into the universe as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah,
because you talk about stuff like jokes. Eight Crazy Nights and like the pooping deer and stuff. Yeah,
the magic of it all. It's great. The anachronisms, that's really where I come to. They're just playing Dungeons and Dragons. The fact that like Taylor Lautner sitting there and he's like, so I'm sitting outside eating an ice cream cone. Ice cream cones weren't invented until like the 1900s. My character is sitting outside of the bank eating an ice cream cone. I've just invented them.
I am the inventor of ice cream cones.
It's on my character sheet, all right? If you're going to be a dick about it, it would be funny. It's something that would work for me, and it explains a lot of those moments, especially like I could totally see them like doing the poker game, and they're like,
only if Kevin James is the DM. Like that's the big joke of the whole thing is Kevin James is behind a cardboard cut, like stand with like a wizard hat on and just like angry at them for fucking up the story he was trying to tell.
Oh, I want Kevin Can Wait, Kevin James specifically, where he just like flies off the handle like, come on, this was supposed to be something. First of all, I wanted it to be medieval times, but you insisted on the Old West. And now you can't even stick to the Old West. Harvey Keitel as the devil from the... It just feels like a riff. This whole thing just feels like a riff. And
for sure.
I don't know. But it's definitely in there. I think it's definitely in there. Okay, cool. So that has been this episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Any laws that this one introduces? Or is it pretty much just there because it is built on the backs of the other 17 movies we've watched up to this?
Yeah, I guess at some point we got to cross that bridge, right? And this might be the best one to do it on. I can't think of anything specific that this movie introduces, except, you know, no, not really. Just this kind of – this love of the absurd, which I think we've seen in a lot of them and I'm sure we've talked about. But that, I feel like that also has to be an element for this. Like one of the reasons that you get the feeling right away that something like a Punch Drunk Love doesn't work or something like a Funny People doesn't work is because there's not an absurdity to the world that they're in that makes it work. The second that there is like a grounded reality, it kind of just pulls it out of that universe immediately, right? So if anything, I would say that it just reinforces something that we've maybe known all along to the point that it becomes a law, and that's that there has to be absurd elements at some point.
I don't hate that as a absurdity is a must.
Yeah. Like as usual, laws are subject to change as we see fit. But I think that this movie really kind of proved for me that even in all of my disdain for this film, I could never at any point deny that I felt like it fit right in with some of my favorites. So,
Abner Doubleday, man. That worked for me so well.
Yep.
I hate how much that scene works for me. But, like, I've stolen a base. You weren't paying attention. I've stolen the base.
I'm stealing it.
Right. All right. That's the halfway point. No, no, no. It has been nine innings.
Two times.
That is enough.
All right.
It has to be between my knees and my titties. Otherwise, it's a not strike.
John Turturro, you are a gift.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch, like, some of the movies where he has a bigger role. Because he has just been in the background for so many of these.
I gotta get that Mr. Deeds in then, man.
No, it's
one of my
coming.
Favorite ones. So.
Well, we'll see what happens. All right, so this has been Ridiculous 6, continuing our theme of exploring the villains and those films and what it means to be a villain in the ASCU is a very interesting discussion. For next month, what we're going to be looking at is Uncut Gems, the Softies film, and it has just been announced that Adam is going to be doing another film with them. So that should be fun, right, Seijin?
Yeah, I'm excited to give it a watch. I mean, I have not, to be clear right now, I've not seen it yet. And from what I understand, an intense movie. So buckle in, people. Like, it's a hard watch.
Yeah, it's something. It's and really, this could be it. This could be the series finale. I don't want to, like, it's probably not going to be the series finale, but the fact that when the Hubie Halloween discussion of a cinematic universe started, and then the immediate second question after, how did he get Steve Buscemi to be in Hubie Halloween?
I thought you were going to say, is Uncut Gems in the universe also? Because that was the second question I heard.
Right. But the question one was Steve Buscemi, and then question two was, how does Uncut Gems fit?
Yeah, how does Uncut Gems
fit? And it's like, well, maybe it doesn't, guys. Like, it doesn't have to. But we've done all the work so far, 18 episodes up to this point, to determine what does and what does not constitute an Adam Sandler cinematic universe in our own Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And we'll see if maybe this one does it. And I'm excited to find that out in June. Until then, if you've enjoyed what you've heard today with a focus topic, we also do a weekly podcast called The Say Report that comes out every Monday. And
which is extremely focused right now, I will point out.
Yes,
but
that's because it's May, because it is the month of May, we are celebrating the Brendan Fraser History Month, as we do every May. So if you like us focusing on Adam Sandler and you want to hear us focus on Brendan Fraser, definitely check out the new stuff we're doing. But then older episodes and future episodes will definitely go back to the anything. A show about everything. That is the Say Report. So it should be exciting. If you would like to get in touch with Seijin to further discuss just all of the atrocities that this film represents, he can be found on Twitter at Siege versus the World.
And if you want to film yourself acting as Abner Doubleday coming up with more rules for baseball, you can then send that to Devin at Devin D. Decker. I'm sure you would love it.
Oh, I'd love it. If you want to come up with anybody, you want to come up as Naismith inventing basketball, you come up with Wayne Gretzky inventing hockey, because we all know
all
that's what he did.
They all have to be played like John Turturro playing Abner Doubleday in this movie in just oldie-timey clothes and talking like that.
Yeah, your direction is, act like John Turturro in The Ridiculous Six as the inventor of beloved sports, and I'd love to see them.
I got three in, boys. I believe we should call that a hat trick.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Mr. Gretzky.
That's Wayne Douglas Gretzky. You use all three of the names for a hat trick. I don't think that one's going to stick, great one. All right. Well, until next time, please just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good one. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.